Hi, if I could take a moment of your time before we start, if you've enjoyed previous episodes or if you enjoy this episode, if you could subscribe on the platform that you listen to, that would be really helpful. It helps us get more guests and push the podcast forward. Thanks.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Car Chat. And with me on this episode.
Friendlier than expected.
Is Adam Christodoulou. Hello, Adam.
How's it going?
Not bad. So Adam is, you are at Adam Christo on Instagram and social media and yep. All of these things. And you are a factory race driver. Is that the best way of describing yourself?
I suppose at the moment, yes. So things have been going great the last few years. I signed with AMG back in 2016 and I've managed to keep the ball rolling. We've had some great victories and successes along the way and I suppose it'll be time to renew my contract soon. It's one of them things. It's always this time of year you get a little anxious of how it would go, but they've put me in for one of the last VLNs at the Nürburgring, which is this weekend coming. So I'm feeling pretty good about plans for next year. And there's a few things already signed for next year as well. So I'm pretty confident that I'm going to be doing a fairly similar program or I'm going to be equally as busy as I have been this year.
Yeah, awesome. So can you sort of run through vaguely, well, overall, how you got to be the position of driving a factory Mercedes GT3 race car?
Well,
how did you get into racing?
So basically, it was my 7th birthday and my dad took me to the garage and the garage went up and there was this machine and it was my first ever go-kart. And so it was a 60cc Coma cadet kart and very small, like still too big for me at the time. But like, thankfully, I grew into it and he got me a helmet as well. So as a kid, I used to run around the house with this bright yellow helmet. And I don't know whether it was one of my dad's old ones or whether it was just one of his mates or something, but anyway, it was at the house. And so we used to run around with this, wearing this helmet. And so anyway, so of course it came to my 7th birthday, got the car. And next Saturday we went testing. So of course got me a suit. This thing just like drowned me because they didn't do suits that small. nowadays they do all sorts of, they do the micro carts. So kids can start at the age of 3 now.
Three?
Yeah, they can start testing at the age of 3 now, which is
incredible. That's crazy, because like, the kids haven't been walking for that long at 3.
Well, yeah, I know. So, in fact, I think it was about 4 years old when we tried to get my brother into karting, and basically we had this massive rope, and Dad was like, right, you need to run behind the kart. And of course, if it got out of control, you just had to like try and like hoist this thing and lift the back wheels up so that my little brother wouldn't go flat out. Like, and we had it on the ground, like, and thankfully, my parents got some decent amount of land. So this was in the garden because we thought, right, we'll test it there where it's a bit safe. And that's what we ended up doing, running around the garden behind him. And if it got a bit out of control, we'd just pull the thing up and just lift the rear wheels up. But yeah, I started when I was 7 and I went testing most Saturdays. And actually, to be honest, during the first year of karting, I got a bit bored of it. Like, I didn't understand where it was going and that. So anyway, my dad kept on sort of like pushing me to do it. And of course, it came to the weekend of my birthday. I had my first race at Shenington, and I finished sixth overall, and I won the novice trophy. And as they say, the rest was history kind of thing. And once I got rewarded for finishing, obviously, and for being first in the novice category, I couldn't wait until the next weekend to go racing again. So yeah, basically it was just non-stop from there.
That
so
really I started the bug.
Exactly. So I did 10 years of karting. So I raced in Coma Cadet. I raced in a bit of TKM, Mini Max, Junior Max, a little bit of Yamaha as well, all the way through the karting categories. I did a few races in Europe, in JICA and ICA, and then eventually moved into Formula Renault in 2007.
Is that quite a big jump from, well, first of all, the first karts are, like, I'm guessing, pretty slow. And then what, by the time you were finishing karting, what sort of kart were you in at that point? They're pretty rapid things.
The cadets, the Coma cadets are 60cc, but of course they weigh nothing. I think the total weight is about 95 kilos. That's including the driver.
Yeah.
So you've got 6 horsepower and it's 95 kilos. And so the things still, they still reach like 55 mile an hour, which is
that's pretty fast.
Which is bloody rapid for when you're 7 years old. And of course, back then, like, you're fearless, so it doesn't really matter. And then eventually, like, when you get to Rotax, I think they're pushing about 26, 27 horsepower. And you're able to reach higher speeds of maybe 80 mile an hour, but you just get there a hell of a lot quicker.
Yeah.
And obviously, suddenly, you start to put your elbows out and you can really get stuck in, I suppose, as you grow up.
I've seen some videos of, like, some karting accidents where, like, nasty stuff happens. People go, like, upside down and things. You ever had any bad karting accidents?
Yeah, a few too many. I suppose because when I was racing karts, like, I'd race maybe 47, 48 weekends a year.
That's some schedule.
The majority of the weekends, I'd be racing two karts as well. So I'd race Mini Max and Junior Max at the same time, or I'd race Yamaha and TKM at the same time during the weekend. And I was the driver. My dad was the engineer, and my older cousin, Jamie, was the mechanic. And so, of course, we were flat out. And every now and again, we had to get a second mechanic when we were doing the separate classes. So we were flat out all the time. And during my karting career, I had 4 separate occasions. I ended up rolling the thing. So I suppose it was my first accident, which was probably my worst. And sadly, or unfortunately, my mom was there. And of course, like, she didn't want to see me drive ever again kind of thing. But that one, I suppose, took me the longest to recover physically and sort of mentally as well.
Did you break something?
I don't think I ever broke something, but it was only once I was older I've realised that I've got quite a bit less movement in my back than most normal people. So I've had to, like, take up yoga the last few years as my back went into spasm literally like 2 days before I was going skiing a few years ago. And so I ended up going on the ski holiday, but ended up watching for 4 days before I went to the hospital and had some pain relief and off I went kind of thing. So I've had 4 major accidents in karts or where I've ended up rolling the thing, but each time, like, I think the last 2 times I ended up racing that same weekend. Yeah. It's like, right, get the thing back over on all 4 and right, let's just rub the dirt off and off we go kind of thing. So, so that was my karting incidents. Thankfully, we had a lot more success than we did injuries and accidents.
Of course, well, and it's one of those things, I guess. You said you were racing 48 weekends a year and sometimes in multiple cars. You're definitely getting your 10,000 hours in. But
yes, so I think from just my karting, I think I ended up with about 160 victories and about 350 trophies altogether.
That's insane. Like,
at my parents' place, when they bought it, the end room, which we sort of classed as like the trophy room, we ended up just building shelving all the way around the edge of the room, and that's where everything went. And so now they're all in boxes in the loft somewhere.
You haven't been tempted to put them up in your place?
Sadly, well, Mom did say that. She was like, oh, great, when you move out, you can take all your trophies with you. And my girlfriend, Lyd, was like, Pam, you do realise we're going to be moving into a 3-bed apartment, not a house. Like, we don't have a garden, we don't really have a loft and stuff. So anyway, like, I think there's like, I don't know, 13 or 14 boxes worth of trophies. And, and these aren't just small boxes. These are like, they only fit through the loft hatch when they're folded. And then we've had to like make them in the loft. So anyway, so they're upstairs collecting dust.
They're there for when you want them at some point.
Well, I said to my dad, I was like, what do we do with these? He was like, I don't know. I was like, well, we try and sell them or recycle them? He's like, no. He goes, I've invested into all of them trophies. They're mine. So, they're still at home.
You could melt them all down and turn them into a sculpture.
Well, that, I always thought that. It's like, right, let's melt them all down and just make one massive trophy.
Yeah, yeah. But, this is my life.
Just one big pot. Just keep all the little plaques and everything of what position they are.
So you finished karting and you went into Formula Renault. So that's a jump into single-seater.
Yep.
Was that a big change going from driving a kart to a single-seater or not so much?
There was, yeah, like it is quite a big change. And it's, of course, suddenly you're having to deal with gears. Like a lot of karts, unless you move into the shifters unless you move into the shifter karts, they're either direct drive where you've got to run along and then basically slam the back of the karts into the ground and that kickstarts the engine.
Okay, yeah.
It's like a jump, like bump starting a road car. So they don't have a clutch. Or, so some of the karts are touch and go. And basically it's got a clutch on it, an automatic clutch. So you start the engine, you accelerate, and it engages the clutch the higher it revs. And so suddenly you move into a car and you've got an actual clutch and you've got six gears.
And brakes on the front wheels.
And you've got brakes on the front wheels. So of course, suddenly you can lock up the fronts. And of course, in karting, like when you're driving, you're almost like reversing it into a lot of the corners to get the thing rotated, to get the rear wheel in the air so that it doesn't create the drag around the corner and stuff. And then suddenly in a car, you've gone from being almost the biggest part of that vehicle in the kart to suddenly you've got an engine that probably weighs three times what you weigh kind of thing. And so there is a huge difference. And of course, most cars, or when you move into single seaters, they've got aero as well, which of course is something a little bit unnatural compared to anything that you've been in before. So there is quite a difference. Suddenly it's not as easy to overtake because in a kart, obviously the vehicles are very short, whereas in a car you've got the downforce, so you lose a little bit on the corners if you're close to the cars in front, and then of course on the straights because of the slipstream you'll catch back up. But it takes a little bit of time to get your head around, but I'd been in karting for plenty of years, so I believe I picked it up fairly quickly. I went over to Ireland a lot. I went testing like 2 days a month for maybe 6 months before I did my first winter series race in Formula Renault, and then that was at the end of 2006, 2007. I competed in the Formula Renault British Championship. Formula Renault British Championship. So that was a good season. It was at the start of the year, it's like, right, okay, where during pre-season I was like fifth and sixth, and I remember my dad asking me, he was like, right, where do you think you're gonna finish this year? And I was like, I don't know, maybe fifth, sixth, and he's like, who do you think's going to be in front? And I remember him like sort of like losing his losing it a little bit with me, like, this isn't good enough. Anyway, I remember at the time my teammate was Jeremy Metcalf, and he's like, Peter, which is my dad, he's like, don't worry about it. He goes, we'll get to the first race and we'll be up there. And funnily enough, as it happened, we got to the first race and suddenly we were up there. And of course, a lot of teams, which is the sort of a shame thing about it, is weight is a big advantage or disadvantage, obviously a big advantage if you're underweight. And so what a lot of the teams do is to get people going and obviously to build up confidence and that, they'll run the cars a little bit lighter. And then suddenly it comes to the first race and everyone's got to be on equal terms and reality kicks in a little bit. So that was good for us. I finished fourth in my first year of Formula Renault, won the rookie championship. And then the next year in 2008, I went on to win the championship. So that was brilliant back then. And of course, we were having conversations like with McLaren and stuff, and Anthony Hamilton managed us for a short while as well, me and my cousin. And of course, at the time, it's like, oh, you could be like the Schumacher brothers. Blah, blah. And of course, we were like, oh, this would be brilliant. But sadly, it's just one of them things that we just couldn't generate enough sponsorship to go to the next level. So I ended up doing an F3 test. It didn't quite go to plan. I was testing next to Bottas. And even though we'd raced in Formula Renault, we'd had some good battles between us. And suddenly in the F3 test, it was just miles ahead. And it's like, what the hell is going on anyway? The test didn't go as planned. And of course, we were a bit down from that. And then we found out that the team had already signed all four drivers for the next season. So, of course, again, reality check that it was one of them. Like, sadly, they took our test money.
Yeah, your spot.
And they'd already got all their drivers ready for next year. So I ended up had conversations with my dad, like, what's the plan now? Do we maybe do the British? Because it was a bit more affordable compared to the European F3. And then we're like, well, maybe in America, maybe that's the better direction to go to. So I went out there for a two-day test at Sebring, and I tested the Star Mazda. So it's a rotary engine. It's got three rotors on it, and the thing screams and it spits out flames out the back of it kind of thing. Sounds pretty awesome. Big wheels, like very everything's on it's just like bigger than life kind of thing. It's got a massive rear wing, it's got massive tires on it, and it's pretty awesome car to drive. So I ended up doing the 2-day test, and I was quickest there three out of the five sessions, and then second quickest in the other two sessions. And by the time I'd made it home, the news had come out that I hadn't actually signed with the team I was testing with, and so I'd almost had an email off every single team saying, right, come and race for us. And I had a load of different budgets and options to go with. And so I ended up going with, I raced Star Mazda with, JDC Motorsport and John Church. And he was kind enough to look after me for the season. And we went on to win the Star Mazda Championship. So, of course, that was brilliant for us and part of winning that championship. Of course, at the time, the exchange rate was good. So that helped us because the pounder, the pound was stronger than it is right now.
At one point in time.
And also the prize money was brilliant over there as well. And so if you won the championship, Mazda funded your next season's racing in the next
That's
category.
Quite a big
so it's
incentive.
Like, wow, right, okay. And so we won the championship and Mazda wanted me to race in the Atlantic Series, but unfortunately that collapsed. And so that ended up changing a few things for me, and in the end I think it was a blessing in disguise because they put me in their sports car program in their Mazda RX-8 with Speed Source, and I raced with John Edwards, who's now one of the factory drivers for BMW. So we raced in the Mazda together, and we had a pretty awesome season, but we missed the first round of the championship. And of course it got to the end of the season, they're like, right, we want you to come back, blah blah blah. I was like, yeah, great, we'd love to. And they're like, right, how much sponsorship can you bring? And of course at the time I was like, I was like, there's nothing left. So they're like, well, anyway, we're going to honour the Daytona 24 Hours because we missed it because it's so early in the season. They're like, we'll honour it for next year. So, of course, I came back home and I was thinking, wow, I'm about to do a 24-hour race, and the longest race I've competed in is 4 hours.
Okay, like, yeah, yeah.
How am I going to prepare for this? So, of course, there was, in the UK, there used to be the Brit Car 24 Hours around Silverstone. So the plan was, I was thinking, well, maybe if I can do that, that just give me a bit of an idea of whether I'll be able to sleep during the race and how exhausted I'll end up getting and all of that. So I rang my old team manager that I won the Formula Renault with, and I said to him, I was like, look, do you know anyone in the Brit Car 24 Hours? It's on this date. And so I gave him all the info, and he comes back to me the next day. He's like, look, because I don't know anyone there, because I had you fancy driving our Ferrari GT2 that weekend at Monza. I was like, dad, I need a flight to Italy. So off I went to Italy. Raced with Tim Mullen and CRS Racing, and we finished third. So
nice.
Never been to the track before, never driven this car. Like, yeah. Old school, proper sequential on the thing. No ABS.
What sort of year was this?
This would have been 2011. The very start of 2011. So, no, sorry. The end of 2010. And so I did that race, and they're like, right, great job. Do you want to do the next one? Same again. This one's in Barcelona. They're like, just get yourself a flight and a hotel and off you go kind of thing. So really threw me a lifeline there. And I ended up going there, and there was a test day. So we ended up doing the test day. And there's a few different drivers there, and there was two seats in one of the GT2 Ferraris. And Andrew, the team manager, was like, well, why don't you jump in and see whether you can teach one of the other guys? So everyone's like, no, you're mad. I was like, well, it's fine. They're like, what happens if you crash? And I was thinking, well, surely we'll be going at a slower speed if I crash with him than if I was on my own kind of thing, like a little naive. So, so anyway, jumped in, and of course the car was that loud. Like, it was a straight exhaust on the thing, and it was like a shotgun going off on the pit limiter. It was unreal. Like, the popping and banging was unreal.
It sounds so badass.
Yeah, it's really, really loud and really cool. Like, it's funny how you get used to quiet motorsport now. Like, if you hear something loud now, it's like, oh, my ears. But of course, back then, you'd feel it going through your body. The thing was that loud.
I've just come back from the Peter Auto event at Paul Ricard.
Right, so, okay, yeah.
And I was taking pictures of the 90s and 2000s Le Mans car grid.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
We had a 458 GT2.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, everything's and on straight pipes.
Coming towards you, it's not that bad. It's as soon as the exhaust gets past the point where you're standing.
It's like 8 times louder.
Yeah, it's incredible. It like blows you away kind of thing. And so we ended up racing that, and that race I finished second. So it's like, right, great, okay then. And during the winter, basically, the guy that ended up coaching on the 2 days, of course, we're going around. I was like, right, go. I was like, on the brakes. I was like, right, third gear this corner. Like, just the wheel.
You've got a bunch of hand signals now for when you're in the car.
Yeah, almost. Like, well, even when I instruct now, like, I'm very animated with how I do stuff. I'm like, right, go, 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 go. Right now, full power kind of thing. Because, of course, even whilst coaching, or it doesn't matter what you're doing, you can't just stamp on the power, because that's when you get a big energy transfer through the car. So you've always got to feed it, and you've got to give the car notice of what you want it to do. So it's the same with, I suppose it's why I'm animated as well. And also every now and again, I get my left and right wrong. So of course it's just better if I just point. Right, okay, let's turn it in now.
That way.
Yeah, turn left. Your left or my left? No. So
do you ever have like mics to the each person?
Yeah, so a lot of the coaching that I do, I've got two Renault Clios that I use for coaching. Okay. And they've both got dual control, so I've got a clutch and brake in the passenger side.
Oh, nice.
I've got a data logger in it as well. And so when I get someone new, literally the data logger takes a picture of that person. And then on the map, you can download it onto my iPad. I use it's called a Race Navigator. It's a brilliant piece of software and equipment. So it's extremely popular at the Nürburgring. So it'll draw the outline of the track, and then you can put it over Google Maps and you can actually see on the track, like you can zoom into the thing. And you can see the difference of, right, you're a meter over to the left compared to me.
Oh,
and,
wow, that's really cool.
And then you can look at the braking points and all of that. So it's a real useful bit of kit that I use for coaching. It's almost, they've made a race car version for it, but it was more for like road cars. Like it's just plug and play. Literally, you can take it out into the cigarette lighter, powers it up. You can put on there what car you're in. It's already got some preloaded cars in there. I've got like a plug that goes into the OBD. So it tells you your throttle and like the revs and stuff. Not most road cars don't have a brake
sensors and stuff,
pressure sensor, but some of the Porsches and stuff do. So it's a real great piece of like kit that you can use. So I end up using that for coaching, and you can see like how you get on the power and how aggressive you are. And it's also got like all the G sensors and everything on it. So I end up using that. And yeah, it's just a great tool for coaching. And of course, so in that you can talk to each other. It's very civilized because it's a road car.
It's not like that,
whereas suddenly if you're in a race car, like if you're in the, I do a lot of coaching for young drives in the Ginetta Juniors and the Ginetta GT5.
Yeah.
And they are too loud, and you've got your full face helmet on as well. So that's when I run a Stilo helmet. And so I've got like the Stilo kit, which I can plug into everyone else's helmets as well.
Okay.
And then I've got like an emergency ear piece kit, which you can just slide each side of the driver or in between the driver's ears and the helmet. So at least I can talk to them. They might not necessarily be able to hear them, but generally it's me, the one that's doing all the talking whilst they're working on their technique and concentrating on what's in front of them.
With some of the, like the GT cars, can you put a second seat in them?
At the end of the day, all GT cars are based on road cars.
Yeah.
And so there is normally a space in the passenger side. We've got a seat for the AMG GT3, but in the AMG, it's like we've got a carbon fiber monocell in the car. And so it's almost like a Formula car cockpit, like that's been wedged into the actual race car. And so we've done it for safety. And also we're able to make all the seats are personalized. So the biggest driver tends to get the base layer.
Okay.
And then each driver that's smallest, I'm always one of the smallest. So I end up basically with like a booster seat that ends up slotting straight into theirs. And the pedals adjust and the steering wheel adjusts. And so I raced with Klaas, and he's almost 2 meters tall. So that's quite
quite a
bit taller than I am. And in fact, that was the Mercedes was the first car that he jumped in, and he looked small in it just because I suppose it's just a base seat. So you can have him as high or as low as they feel.
So
correct.
When you get in the car, can you move the pedals?
Yeah. So we've got a little lever to the right of us.
Oh, that's really good.
Yeah, it is to the right of us. And yeah, the pedals just slide forward, backwards and forwards, and then just like a road car underneath, and you can pull it up, down, and you can position yourself, and then you lock it in. And then generally we've got our driver ID as well. So like during a pit stop change, we've got our 5-point harness. So of course you jump in, you grab the first belt, and the driver that's jumped in does the first connection to the buckle. The driver on the outside, whilst you're doing this, he's plugging in your radio and your drink system.
Yeah.
Then he goes straight in with the second. Whilst he's doing that, you're finding it's either like on a magnet or it's on Velcro for your shoulder strap, and that goes in. And then he puts in the final strap and pluggers in the window net, slams the door, and off you go kind of thing. And we end up doing all of that. Like we've been able to get it to down to like 14-15 seconds, which you need to in the sprint series. Like when you're doing the Blancpain sprint, if you're not within like 17 seconds, you're losing time. And of course, if you lose 1 second in the pit lane,
that's so
if you're only 1/10 a lap quicker, it could take you 10 laps to eventually catch that 1 second up. So it's vital not to lose any time during the pit stops. In the endurance stuff, generally, we'll have a longer time, or like in British GT, just to make it easy, because a lot of it's pro-am racing. So that's one pro driver and one amateur, like, or a gentleman driver. Every driver's graded bronze, silver, gold, platinum. And so you're only allowed a certain combination. I'm gold. And so it's the only time you almost want to underpromote yourself.
Yeah. You're gonna be like, no, I've had a really bad year.
Yeah. downgrade me. So, like, of course, so in British GT, you're allowed like a bronze and a gold. Well, you're allowed a bronze and anything, but your strongest lineup's going to be a bronze and a gold, or a bronze and a platinum. The difference between bronze, gold and platinum is very minimal. Like, it's, if you've got a super license, or if you've won Le Mans 24 hours, you're classed as a platinum.
Okay. What's a super license? So like F1 or something?
Yeah, for F1. And so I think that's the only championship you need a super license for. And so that makes you a platinum. Gold is like factory drivers or drivers that have proved themselves. And then silver is generally the up-and-coming drivers. So basically, after 1 year's racing, you automatically become a silver if you're under the age of 30.
Okay.
Because, of course, when you're younger, you pick things up a lot quicker, and you'll be able to, you'll just be able to learn and improve a lot quicker. Whereas if you start over the age of 30, you're almost bronze for life. So then you'll be able to partner yourself up with the best or the strongest combination you can put together. So in British GT, it's pro-am. So you got to have one bronze and a gold or a platinum, or you can have two silvers. And then there's a minimum pit time, just so that the drivers are putting the cars correctly and you've got all the belts. It's only mainly in the super pro categories where you've got to do it as fast as possible. But then at the same time, of course, fuel, again, depending on the championship, sometimes you can only fuel and then you can do the tyres after. Some of them you're allowed to do fuel and tyres at the same time. And of course, this ends up making the pit stops shorter. So generally there's enough time to get yourself in, make sure your belts are all correct, get them all tightened up and get your steering wheel and everything correct, and do your driver ID. And
do you find there's a compromise in your seating position because of multiple drivers, or is actually the way it's worked, at least for you, it's not so bad?
Sometimes it's a little difficult, like, especially if you're doing a 24 hours, you want to make sure that the seat's as close to perfect for you, because If you're moving around in the car, of course, you end up stabilizing yourself using your shoulders without realizing. And you can be in the car for up to 3 hours. Like, that's generally the maximum length stint that any driver's allowed to do in, like, the Spa 24 hours or the Le Mans 24. For me, I think Spa 24 hours is the most physical 24 hours there is out there, because, like, Nürburgring, okay, it's known as the green hell, but actually a lot of it's very flowing.
Okay.
And so it's just lots of little movements going all the way through.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas Spa, like, turn one, the source, big braking zones. Okay, like, you're hard on the brakes. You go into the seat, into the belt, and then you go straight down, flat out into Eau Rouge. Like, you're doing Eau Rouge at, like, 220 kilometres an hour in a GT3 car, and it's, like, borderline touch and go flat out all the way through the thing. So suddenly you're going through there, and that's, like, a little kink to the left, and then obviously the compression up the right and then over the top. And then you get to the end of Camel Straight, and you've got turn 5, 6, and 7, and that's a left, right, left. So suddenly you're like going through there and you're getting thrown around, and then you go into Brussels hairpin, and then there's no name corner, I think it's called, and then it goes into Puan and all of that, and that's just a long loaded corner, and that's only half the track.
Yeah.
And so, like, there's almost no time to, like, catch your breath kind of thing, whereas at least at the Nürburgring, everything's just little adjustments. And you'll get like maybe a 10-15 second break before you've got to, like, have a big braking zone, but then generally it's all very flowing at the Nürburgring. Once you get to, like, the tallest part of the track after the carousel, that part starts to get, well, you're pretty busy through there, but then you've got the back straight all the way back to the pit lane, which is like 3 kilometers to catch your breath back and try and get in the slipstream get dragged along with someone.
It sounds really cool. My only experience of that is I've got a Radical SR3.
I've
driven that at a couple of tracks, but I did Spa earlier this year.
Yeah, what do you
and
think?
I just ruined my neck. Like, I've never been so dead after a day. We did a day with, it's not SRO, but one of those track day organisers where you just had, we just had tons and tons of track time.
So it'd have been Curbstone. So Curbstone's owned by SRO. So you're either allowed GT3 or GT4 race cars, or there's a road car group, but it's got to be like a high performance road car. So nothing less than 400 horsepower kind of thing. So, and those days are pretty full on.
It was wicked. And it was awesome. Love it being on track with all those other cars.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's quite fun, like, rinsing the old GT4
It's classed
car.
As a track day, but with test day rules where you're allowed to overtake on any side, which is very unusual. Like, in the UK, almost all the track day companies only allow you to overtake on the left-hand side, and it's for safety and insurance. Otherwise, the prices end up going up, and then, of course, at the end of the day, it ends up being the customer that ends up having to pay for it, the more exclusive it is, or the more free you're allowed to do stuff. So I understand why they do it, to have more people on the track days and just to make it safe for everyone, because on a track day, you can have, as long as your car is below the noise limit, you can almost take anything, whether it's a race car or not. If it is a race car, so you've got to wear all the full fireproof and everything correctly for it. But of course, the last thing you want to do is go into a corner and someone suddenly dive bombs you without experience and you connect. So whereas on a test day, generally at that point, you should have more experience and there should be less dramas like that happening anyway, and it should run smoothly.
Weirdly, it doesn't always seem to be like that. My experience of some GT3 cars, sometimes with Lamborghini badges on.
a lot of them.
Doing a lot of late braking, a lot diving down the inside. And it's one of those things, I'm so much more comfortable with other cars on track than I used to be, whatever, like 3 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
So overtaking either side, especially if I'm in like the Radical, for example, it's just so much better, because when the first car starts braking, you don't start braking for another bloody 200 metres.
Oh, yeah, the Radical can slow down within half the distance of most road cars just because of the aero that it's got, and it's a road car. It's a race car rather than a road car, and it's got slick tyres on it normally, and so the performance of the Radical is pretty incredible, and just power to weight ratio, them things, that makes some mini rocket ships.
They're pretty hilarious.
Like, the top speed isn't as fast as some of the others, but the cornering's unreal, the braking's unreal, and the initial acceleration's pretty rapid on them.
Yeah, I've always found it really interesting being on track with GT3 cars, because obviously they're so much faster on the straight, but in the corner they're like similar, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Potentially even a little bit slower.
I think around Silverstone, I think they're almost the same lap times.
Yeah.
And of course, but Silverstone's a bit of a different track, because it's, even though it's got quite a long straight, everyone's like, oh no, because of the long straight, you need minimum downforce. But actually everything at Silverstone is like third, fourth gear, like all the corners. Mm. So you need a lot of downforce for the stability and to have the thing sucked to the floor going around these corners. So actually in the UK, it's one of the highest downforce circuits that we've got, because all the corners are high speed.
Yeah.
Okay, on the straight, it might hurt you a little bit, but if you carry that extra 3-4 kilometers at the start of the straight, by the time you get to the end of the straight, it doesn't make any difference whether you've got the extra downforce or not. But yeah, Silverstone, I think the Radicals are very close to the GT3 cars, whereas in Shanghai 2 weeks ago, the GT3s were miles quicker just because the track's a lot more stretched out and there's a lot more straights.
Yeah. Are GT3 cars much quicker now than they were 5 years ago?
They could be. so we have this thing called BOP, balance of performance, and at the end of the day, like, a Ferrari would be quicker than a Bentley, like on the track, if it was allowed to just be fully unleashed. So they do this thing where BOP, everything's got to be within a certain aero window, so they'll go aero testing with every manufacturer on the straight to see how much it compresses, and they'll do a lot of stuff on the rigs as well, and they'll see how much it slows down, like once you like lift off the power. And then every brand's got its strengths and weaknesses. And so what they do is they try and get everything so it's the same lap time. So, of course, there's a bit of politics involved. But generally, like, Mercedes and the Audi are almost like the two benchmark cars. They haven't changed much over the last few years. So they're the benchmark. And then they just, everyone else is to be within the window to try and make them all spot on. So, like, the Mercedes is super good on its tyres. It's not the quickest on the straights, but it's good around the high speed corner, super stable, and it seems to give everyone a lot of confidence. Everyone that jumps in it seems to do extremely well very soon, whereas like the Bentley and the Nissan and the Porsche seem to have good top end speed, but their tire degradation might be a bit more harsh, so they'll run out of tires towards the end of a stint, for example. And then The Porsche's got great traction because of where the motor's located in the car. So, of course, that like comes off the hairpins like a rocket ship. But then its high-speed cornering isn't quite as strong as like the Mercedes, for example. The BMW's super good around high-speed corners as well. And big flowing tracks is good for the BMW. So every car's got its strengths and weaknesses. And they basically try and get everything so it does roughly the same lap time. And that's what generates all this great racing that you've got all these different brands and all of them can compete against each other. And of course, the teams have to do lots of testing. Like every car, like each year will get a little bit quicker and a little bit quicker. And then they'll just try and control it if it starts to get a little out of control. But the SRO and the FIA do a brilliant job at making sure that everyone's within the parameters and all the cars are homologated. So you can't do development. Like this was one thing that was getting out of control a few years ago where like maybe 2011, 12, 13, that you just end up developing new parts for the cars. And of course, suddenly the price was spiraling out of control. Whereas now a car is homologated for 3-4 years, unless it's got a safety or reliability issue, then it's allowed to make certain adjustments. But of course, everything's becoming more reliable now. So there's very minor changes from year to year.
Yeah, because I don't know why. I thought they would change like every year, like the road cars.
Like I think if you went back 10 years ago now, I wouldn't be surprised if the GT4s are doing the same times as what the GT3s were doing 10 years ago. So we've definitely got quicker over the years. But like I think we run at like maybe 525 horsepower or 500 horsepower, whereas we could probably run an extra 100 to 150 horsepower if we were allowed.
Yeah.
And we could take a lot of weight out of the car and the thing would be like a missile, but not all the manufacturers have that margin to be able to do that. So that's why it's all regulated and everyone's got minimum weight limits and to make sure everyone does the same lap time.
Is there an advantage to like a turbocharged engine versus a naturally aspirated engine in the sense that because you're restricting it, you have more torque in a turbocharged engine?
I don't quite know enough about it, but all the turbo cars have maximum turbo, like the maximum pressure that they're allowed to reach.
Boost, yeah.
And if they go over it, I think they get like one opportunity to go over it and then it's basically disqualification.
Okay.
So everything's controlled. And I think it's like every 100 RPM or something that everything's controlled. So of course there is no gray areas where manufacturers can take advantage of it.
And everything's logged.
Yeah, everything's logged. So a special data logger goes into every car on the grid. So championships supply these to the teams, they have to rent them for the season. And so that measures all the boost pressures. It's all their own sensors. It's all the championship sensors. So there's no being able to like offset anything to try and get away with things. It's just not possible. So everything's recorded by the championship. And of course, if anything steps out of the parameters, then it flashes up red and it'll get investigated. So the championships have worked extremely hard to make sure that it's fair for everyone.
Do you feel like it generally is pretty fair?
Yes. So I think it is fair. Every now and again, there'll be like one manufacturer that suddenly just has an advantage and you're scratching your head trying to understand what's happened here or like how have they managed to do that. But I suppose it's like anything, like in the AMG, we've had a very good run. We're not always the fastest, but we're always within like the top 5% kind of thing. And we're always fighting at the right end of the field. And I think it's like that because like Mercedes and Audi, I think they're very good at showing, right, this is the limit. And of course, it is possible for manufacturers to hide a few things. And then for the big races, they show it. And generally...
Le Mans, anyone?
Well, that's with the GTEs and some of the other things. But in GT3, of course, everything's logged. And I suppose the good thing about GT3 is there's so many cars all over the world. So SRO, they manage the British GT3, the Blancpain Endurance, Blancpain Sprint, the European GT4, the Pirelli World Challenge in America, the FIA Macau race and everything. And so they've got all these brands doing all these things. So there is no hiding. Because, of course, if you give yourself an advantage or you keep your powder dry and then it's going to come back and it's going to haunt you for everything else. So in the end, you've got to show your cards kind of thing. And so I think they do an extremely good job at it. And I think you can see that if you look at all the championships, it's almost so in the end, it was between Mercedes and Lamborghini for the Blancpain Endurance. Yeah. And in the end, just because of the contact and the last Blancpain race ended up being a bit of a mess. And so the Lamborghini ended up winning last year, the Mercedes won. And it's always very close. And at the end of the day, that's what we all want. If it wasn't fair, then people wouldn't do it. And when there's a grid of 50 plus cars, It's because people have trust in the system and that that it's fair for everyone.
Do you have a favourite series that you do? Because you do quite, you throughout the year do quite a lot of different series, don't you?
Yes. So like for example, this year I've been lucky enough that I've been doing the British GT. I've raced in selected VLN races at the Nürburgring Nordschleife, the Nürburgring 24 Hours. I've been racing in the China GT Championship and the Chinese Endurance Championship. And then I did the Spa 24 Hours, which is part of the Blancpain. Like, I suppose the big one that everyone sort of goes for is the Blancpain Endurance Championship. It's the biggest GT3 championship in the world. And you can race the GT3 car anywhere. Like, they've got the championships in America and all that. So for in Europe, the Blancpain is probably the biggest and the one with the most amount of cars. And then there's also like GT Open as well. And then each country almost has its own national championship as well, which you can be a part of. I suppose the Blancpain is one that everyone targets. That's the one where it's probably the most competitive. But like, I love racing at the Nürburgring and I seem to have made a bit of a name for myself there. And so I suppose for me, it's like my second home almost. I go there and generally I know it's going to, unless something goes wrong, it's going to be a good weekend kind of thing. Blancpain, I did the Spa 24 Hours this year. Sadly, we didn't make it to the end, but in a 24 Hours, it's always very, like, just to finish a 24 Hours is a huge success on its own. So unfortunately, we didn't finish this year, but we've had some good results in the past there. So I'm really enjoying going to China at the moment. Just, I don't know whether it's just because every time I go there, it's a massive eye-opener for me. Just like whether it's just the food or the travel, like understanding the people, like, and how they just, their mentality to things over there is completely different to in Europe and in the UK. So that for me is like really exciting, just understanding and learning about their culture over there. And the Chinese GT Championship seems to be growing at quite a rate at the moment. So this year there was maybe 7-8 factory drivers, all in different cars. And of course, we're all working with our AM drivers, just trying to get the best out of them. Of course, the quicker our AM drivers are, the easier it makes our job. And so I've been lucky enough that I've been racing with Eric Zhang. He's the owner of Toro Racing, and he's been putting a lot of time and effort into it, and he's just set up his new team for this season. And it's been great watching the team just grow, and it looks like next year they'll be running, this year they ran the one car, next year they're going to be running at least three cars, just because we've done such a good job during the season. They've already picked up customers for next year, and so it's been good being a part of that. And so I'm expecting that that's going to help make me busy as well next year.
Yeah. How does that work? So at the moment, presumably you have a contract with Mercedes to race for like over the year, or do they just ask you to race certain events? How does that work?
So I've signed exclusive with them. So everything that I race is in the Mercedes. If I want to race anything else, I have to ask permission. So actually last year I did one prototype race at Port Ricard, so that was a new experience for me. So I raced in the LMP3 car, and this year I was a bit unsure whether they'd allow me to, but basically the Wednesday before this Spa 25-hour Funk Up race, I was asked to do that as well. And so I asked them, and to be honest, I thought they were just going to say no, because being a German manufacturer, and they're like, well, yeah, as long as it doesn't overlap any testing regulations for the Spa 24 Hours, then that's fine. So I had my first taste of the VW Fun Cup, the Spa 25 Hours this year, which was brilliant. But my contract for a full season, it just seems to be a rolling contract, and it works well for both of us. I get to do a good amount of media days for them as well. So this year we had Mercedes 125 years of motorsport. So this was a huge event that we held at Silverstone, and we had some real old school classic cars, like the original Gullwing was there.
Oh, cool.
We had a GT3, a GT4 there as well. Some of the old Mercedes rally cars, like the SL230. Bottas was there as well. And so, Lewis Hamilton turned up, Toto Wolff was there. And like, we just all got to jump in these different cars and basically have a fun 3 days, just like going around the international circuit at Silverstone. We had the cameras there, and we were just, well, I felt like we were just playing. I thought it was great.
I saw some videos. I think I saw some of like the Toto and Lewis and what they were driving around. It looked like a wicked time. Just,
oh, it was. It was brilliant. Yeah, it was. It's like, here's some cars. The keys are in them. Which one do you fancy going? So I ended up playing a bit of a late April Fool's joke. So, I asked whether I could sit in the F1 car, like, just because, of course, they were warming it up and all of that. So I managed to squeeze into Lewis's seat.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, can I stick my helmet on? So, of course, I put my helmet on and I got one of the lads to take a few photos. So one of the mechanics there, he was my number one mechanic when I was in the Ferrari GT2, and I've known him all the way through Ferrari and McLaren, and we've always stayed in touch anyway. So he's like, yeah, okay. So anyway, we took a few photos, and then I got a video of Lewis going out the pits and going past on the street. And of course, just amusing myself, I was like, well, that escalated. And of course, I posted it on social media, and it just went wild kind of thing. And in the end, I suppose the joke was on me because everyone thought I had to go in this F1 car.
And I didn't.
So I just got to warm it up for him.
So you've done a ton of 24-hour races now, and you said you got to do the Fun Cup. How did doing the Fun Cup compare to doing, let's say, Spa 24?
The Fun Cup for me was like, so obviously for Spa and for the GT stuff, obviously we've got to take it very seriously. Obviously, it's a huge investment from the manufacturers, from the teams, with time and money and all of that. And obviously, we want to do the best job possible. With the Fun Cup, it was basically it was a family team. So I was racing with dad and his two sons, and there was the four of us in the car. And so not at the same time. Obviously, we drive. We come in after like an hour and 20
four
minutes.
Four in the car would be quite funny.
In the Fun Cup, in a Beetle. So it's got 200 horsepower. It's got some funny little wing on the back of it. And they're just great fun. They're on road tires. So like during a normal 24 hours, we'll change tires maybe 23, 24 times. It's almost once every hour.
Yeah.
How many times do you reckon we change tyres in the Fun Cup?
I'm going to make an educated guess. Seven? Six? Less?
Yeah.
Four?
We changed tyres once.
Once?
During the whole race. We got to like 13 hours and it had worn the outside like edge of the tyre. So we changed the tyre and off we went and did the next 12 hours. the next 12 hours. So, and all the pit stops are like refueling. You've got to be in the fueling station for 5 minutes. And the reason they've done that is because you're putting about 40 litres in it and it lasts for like an hour and 20 minutes or something. And they've realised that if the safety car's on that, there's a huge advantage of coming in the pits and filling there. So what they've done is they've stopped everyone that you've got to pit for 5 minutes. So whether it's a safety car or not, in the end, there's no advantage from pitting. They've managed to make it so it's fair for everyone, or everyone can pit during a safety car, because a safety car is going to always last for like at least 15 minutes around Spa. And so it gives everyone the opportunity, and they'd worked it out that, or we'd worked it out that even if there's 30 cars ahead of you in refueling, you don't get a disadvantage.
Okay. So that's quite interesting, because I'm about to do this weekend, the C1 24-hour.
Right, yeah.
It's a similar sort of joker race. And,
it's incredible how, when you first hear about it, you think, oh, it just sounds like a bag of laughs kind of thing. But actually, it's incredible how serious, obviously, there's a few people that are in it, that is their main championship that they're focusing on. And you can see that in the teams. Like, we were in a team that ran 12 cars.
Yeah.
And of course, there was a handful of us from the team that had a chance of winning. But of course, I was very new to it. And so just understanding some of the strategy with, like, qualifying and that, like, it'll be the same for you. So for qualifying at Spa in a C1, you want to be in a train of about five or six cars, but you've got to work with five or six other cars, and you've got to try and understand which cars are quick so that you can all go out and do the qualifying. So yeah, qualifying started and everyone set their times, and I went out like second or third, and I went out and I was like 2.5 seconds off the pace. And I was like, what the hell's going on? I was thinking, what am I doing? Anyway, it was only once the race had really started that I realized that by working in a group of two or three, you go 2.5 seconds a lot quicker. So for the Fun Cup, there was, I think it was the top 20, like, qualifying to Super Pole. And then they get sent out a minute apart. So during that qualifying, they're all about 2 seconds slower, 2.5 seconds slower than the actual qualifying that they did earlier. And it's just because that's just pure one car, one man, one machine, and no strategy of getting slipstream or anything. And it'll be the same for the
C1s. It's like, the same.
They've got the aerodynamics of a brick. So if you can work with, you're probably going to have to work with like four cars.
Yeah, all line up, bump each other down
all
the
line up, but literally, like, you'll take it in turns, like a relay race, to like go past each other on the straight. I wouldn't be surprised that, like, we were able to overtake going into Eau Rouge, and then if you got the tow going through Eau Rouge, you'd then be able to overtake another car by the end of the straight. And it was like the first time that it was like going back into karting. I remember in karting, like, you could start on the front row, get taken out at the start, drop back to 30th. By the end of your 10, 12, 15 laps, you could be back in like the top five kind of thing, and you'd have a brilliant race. And sadly, that doesn't happen quite as much in GTs or in cars in general. just because of the aerodynamics and all of that. But in the Fun Cup, like we qualified 39th after getting taken out in qualifying. And by the end of the first 45 minutes, I was up into ninth position. Mm. And it's like a game of chess. Like you got to understand, right, if I overtake at La Source and I don't have a toe going into Eau Rouge, I'm going to get eaten alive. Yeah. So it's almost better just to defend, to stop anyone else overtaking you. And then
get the toe
going into Eau Rouge and then try and get the toe going out of it and all of that. And it's like a game of chess almost.
Much strategy involved in all of that. But it's interesting they've removed the safety car aspect of pitting under safety car, because that's normally such a big part of...
Well, what they do is they do racing. They had two safety cars. But I think it was just... The problem is when you've got 130 cars...
you don't want them all to come in at once.
Yeah, if you're coming at once. And of course, if you're the first one to come in, you're going to end up with such an advantage compared to being... Yeah. Like if you're a bang in the middle or you're like the 40th car in, it's going to hammer you kind of thing. So they just try and make it so that...
Which is a bit fair.
Yeah, just to try and make it fair for everyone. And I'm assuming that it might be the same for the Citroën C1. Like we had to go down the Grand Prix pit lane and then the endurance pit lane. It was at the end of the endurance pit lane that we turned right and we went into the fueling station there, and it's all coned off. So I'm assuming that it'll be the same for you guys.
I think we refuel in the pits.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But then there's the whole process of, I think for this,
everyone's got like a hand pump or you just use a
normal can, big can type
thing. Right. Okay. Okay.
And you have to, you're not allowed to have seatbelts done up whilst they're refueling.
Right.
So you can get in the car.
Yep.
Then they start refueling, but they're not allowed to change tires or anything.
Right, okay.
Once they finish refueling, then you can swap tyres or whatever. But normally, I think we were double or triple stinting tyres. But the fuel, a tank of fuel in a C1, drivers were hitting the 3-hour limiter.
On one tank of fuel.
Oh, with like safety cars and in the wet and stuff like that. Yeah. I think flat out, it's like 2 hours 15 or something.
That's brilliant. Like, yeah. In a GT car, you don't go any longer than an hour and 15, an hour and 20 minutes. That's it. Like, you're out of fuel. And that's 120 litres.
Yeah.
Of course, like, generally, we've either got 4-litre turbos or we've got, like, an Armour. We've got a massive 6.2-litre engine just, like, guzzling through fuel.
For people that have never driven a GT3 car, mm-hmm. like myself, for example, how would you explain the difference between a Porsche 911 GT3 RS... very fast, very track capable road car versus the GT3 version? Like, if someone was to do back to back on a track day, what would be the main differences and stuff?
The biggest difference between a road car and a race car is going to be the tyres. It's amazing how much a road car will like sort of move along on a road tyre, even on a wet tyre. And it's because, of course, each block on the tyre will just move a little bit, and that's why you sort of get this like sort of like snaky sort of feeling where you brake and the thing starts wandering into a corner. Whereas you put a slick tire on, and like if each block moves 10 millimeters and you've got 10 blocks across a tire, that's going to move like 100 millimeters, and you're going to feel that during the braking. Whereas if you just suddenly have a slick tire and you hit the brakes, you've got 10 mil of movement over the whole tire. So suddenly the thing's just a lot more planted, it'll be a lot more stable. At least with a road tire, you'll get more tire squeal, which is a warning that it's slipping at that point. So that's like its first cry of help, that either the front sliding or the rear starting to break grip. And then you'll go into like a drift or a slide or a snap. Whereas with a slick tire, you'll have less warning. You'll have more grip, so you'll be able to go quicker, but then you'll have less warning before you do get that snap or you do get that spin. And then a race car is obviously designed for the track, so you'll be able to go on the brakes a lot harder, you'll be able to hammer the tyres for longer, the brakes can handle it for a lot more, whereas a road car, you can maybe do two laps, and then your brakes are going to start overcooking, and then you'll start to feel brake fade, and you'll have to do like a cool down lap before you come in the pits, whereas most race cars are built for going flat out, coming in the pits, stinking hot kind of thing, brakes are glowing, and then you do your fuel change and all that, they can stay stationary for a few minutes. But the difference between a road car and a race car is pretty incredible, and the biggest difference is going to be from the slick tires, and then of course the stability actually is also going to be huge just from having the downforce and stuff, and probably not expecting, like when you first get used to downforce or when you're not used to it, you just won't push it to its limit on the high speed stuff, because of course it's one of the things, the quicker you go, the extra grip that you generate, but obviously that only goes to a certain point, and then there's a crossover, and that crossover is going to be where there's going to be a snap or a big like wobble, or you're going to have to try and catch the thing. So it's, if you ever got the opportunity to have a go in a race car, or even if in a road car, like if you go with an experienced driver in a road car, if you're on your first few track days and you go in a road car with an experienced driver, you'll suddenly understand of where the limits really are. And it's incredible. Like I used to work at Silverstone. So of course I'd be in the passenger seat and I'd be like, right, go, 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 go. We get halfway down the straight and like the driver's almost like looking at me and I'm like, go, 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 go. And I know we can brake at 100 meters, 150 meters. And they're trying to brake at like 500 meters. They're like, it's quite funny actually. When I used to do the experience days at Silverstone, if you were coaching the women, sometimes you could get them going quicker than the guys, and it's because they'd listen to everything you said, whereas the guys would almost try and override. They're
like, no, I know better than you.
Yeah, try and override some of your instructions, and suddenly you brake a bit too late, and then they've got to overslow it, and then they're not in the correct position for the corner. And so, whereas the women, like as long as you continue to talk to them, and you're like, right, brake here, right, squeeze the power, full power, right, look at your exit now, open the steering, and then, right, now we're going to position ourselves here for this corner. As long as you continue talking, sometimes they'll just go quicker, quicker. If you stop talking, like you're going to crash and burn, kind of thing. But as long as you kept on giving them instructions, actually, it was incredible how fast you could get them. And so it's quite interesting, obviously, understanding how women process and listen to things compared to how guys try and probably push our luck.
The psychology of being a driver coach. There's got to be like 90% of the battle a lot of the time, dealing with people.
Yeah, and the thing, everyone learns differently. So like the days I do when I coach is I'll go around, I'll do a handful of laps, right? This is the layout of the track, because it's not in between two white lines around a track. Like we use a few cones around the circuit that I use at Bruntingthorpe. And so I'll do that and I'll just take it easy. And then I'll do a lap at maybe 85%. And then I'll let them drive. And of course, it'll be like very on and off the power and like it, all these movements upset the car and you can feel it from the passenger side. And every now and again, I'll have to like just top up the braking pressure if it's not hard enough. And some drivers pick up the information really quickly and like you can describe it to them and they'll do as you say. And then others will be like, right, let's just stop here. Like we can stop almost anywhere on the track. Just jump out. We'll do a quick driver change. Our driver's like, right, this is what you're doing. You're braking soft here. And then you're ramping up the brake rather than having a big hammer on the brake and then bleeding off and getting the neutral balance going into the corner. And then they'll jump in and they'll mirror it. And so everyone learns differently. And this is what I found with the amount of coaching that I do, that you've got to try all these different techniques just to understand which driver benefits from each example the quickest. And so, and like you said, like sometimes it's trying to get bad habits or trying to like smoothen people's hands. Like it feels quick sometimes if you're fast on the wheel, but actually you're creating like a false limit. And actually smoothness is always key. Like people say, oh yeah, he's an aggressive driver, and you can be aggressive, but that rather than just going from straight line to suddenly like whacking on the steering, you still got to feed it. And then you can start to add more steering, and that's how you get the aggressiveness, but also whilst being quick. And so there's lots of different ways of driving, but there's a few key points. It's quite interesting how obviously a lot of gentleman drivers have been extremely successful in business and all of that, and they can afford to jump straight into their Ferrari GT3 or whatever. Actually, they'll probably learn more in something smaller, learn to get to the limit in that, and then you put that into the next category and you'll take it with you all the way through your racing career. And so, and every now and again, it's just making sure that you don't pick up any bad habits. And so like I do like refresher days with some of my guys that I race with, just to make sure that they're still feeding the steering wheel in. Like you never want any sort of movements, because I suppose the easiest way to explain is if you've got two people stood up and guy A is like blindfolded, if guy B just suddenly with 100 kilos of force just like slams into him, he's going to fall over. He's got no chance to react. Whereas this guy's blindfolded and this guy starts to lean against him, he'll start to react, and then you can still push with the same force, but it's just allowed him the opportunity to react. And it's like the race car or the road car. You never want to just go into a corner and go surprise, like, and throw it in. You always want to feed it, or you want to, like, the only thing that you do aggressively is the initial brake, and then as you start to bleed off the brake, you can start to feed the steering wheel. And so it's understanding, and you'll always understand and be able to process this easier in a smaller car than in a GT3. Like most people in a GT3 race car, they're they're concentrating that much on staying in between the white lines that if you try and talk to them in that, it goes in one ear and comes straight out the other. Like they can just be going, yeah. And it's like, right, what did I just say? I don't know. Whereas at least in a road car, like the Clios that I use, they'll be able to relay the information back to you just because it's going slower. You haven't got to slow it down as much. It's at safer speeds, but the importance is learning how it feels and what's acceptable at the limit of what you've got.
Yeah, because those cars are so fast that for most people, your mental, it's just way over what you can handle.
Even like the Porsche GT3 road cars and that, even some of these are too fast. Like,
they're quick, yeah.
Like, they're super quick and they're on road tires, so they move a lot. And of course, at the end of the day, well, not that I ever want to crash, but I prefer to crash in something slower and a slower speed and have more chance of saving it than in a super quick road car. And it's like if you are learning to fly a plane, like would you learn in a massive jumbo jet? Would you learn in a little four-seater like prop plane?
Yeah, or would you jump in a fighter jet straight away?
Yeah, exactly. So, and it's incredible how many people almost ignore that. And I don't know whether it's just like an ego thing or no. Ferrari is what I'm racing, so this is what I need to learn in. But actually, like, it's like trying to learn the butterfly is your first ever
swim.
Like, you just have no chance. You got to learn to doggy paddle first and keep your head above the water.
I was at Silverstone the other day. We were testing the C1.
Yeah.
And there was a bunch of other people testing the same day. And there were some guys in 488 challenge cars. And I got talking to one of them and was like, oh, you know, here's your very shiny looking challenge car. How you doing? He's like, oh, yeah, I'm just getting into it. And I was like, oh, have you done? And I you sort of spot and you go, I'm just going to ask this question and see how it pans out. Have you done much track day driving, racing, anything before? Like, you know, driving a challenge car, that's quite fast. Or he might have even been in a GT3. And he was like, no, not really. This is my first track day. And you're like, dude.
Good luck.
It's like, I just went to my dealership and was like, oh, I'd like to do some track days. And they're like, yeah, okay, cool. We can get you a GT3 race car and you can spend like 50 grand in a day. And all this stuff.
And even more if you go off.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's mad. Like, I do believe...
I totally get
it. I do believe it should be regulated. And even like some of these hypercars that people end up getting, like, of course, YouTube and all of that. And like, you see like supercar crashes and all of that. And there's just reels and reels of videos like this. And it's just like, the thing is, I believe that if you end up buying such a car, you should almost have to have some kind of training.
Yeah.
Just to understand it and what to do and what not to do in a safe environment with an instructor around a racetrack or something, because it happens too often that people get injured and all of that. And of course, we have to get a race license and start off in the lower categories and build up your signatures before you can upgrade your license to go in something quicker. And why isn't it the same on the road? Like, literally, it's like once you get your license, it's like, right,
it is great.
Go and buy your Bugatti.
It is mind blowing what people will go. And I totally, it's that thing of, you know, the guy who's sold his company or is doing really well, got a big paycheck, and goes, oh, I've always wanted a Ferrari. So goes out and buys a 488 or something and has never driven anything.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Potentially never even driven a rear-wheel drive car before.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're completely fine most of the time because the traction control system's so smart.
But you only need it to. You only need that mistake one time for it to go wrong, and it's the sad truth. Like, I think there should be some kind of regulation.
I really think there should be. I
It'd be good for us as instructors. Like, it'd generate us loads of business. But actually, at the same time, like, honestly, I probably wouldn't teach someone in such a fast car either. Just because at the end of the day, like, it's got to be safe. And of course, if they suddenly believe, right, as an instructor, you're insurance and they're not going to crash, that's not the case. Like, we can help up to certain situations. Yeah. But if you do something that surprises us, we can't always save every situation. Like, as much as we can help manage and improve generally, you still need to start off in something smaller.
Yeah, I know. I did a day with Scott Mansell.
Scott's brilliant. So we use pretty much a very similar layout.
Setup, yeah. And one of the things that I'd done a whole bunch of stuff before then, but I really like the fact that as we were driving around, so we were in an MX-5, and in terms of learning and that sort of stuff, I generally try and chuck it out the window and not go like, oh, I drive a Porsche or whatever. Why am I driving? Because, like, whatever.
Yeah.
And the thing you said, in the MX-5,
yeah,
and we're hooning around, and then I do something like wrong, and you're like, okay, just stop here right now. We're just going to either talk about it or swap over or whatever. And that, as a way of learning, was so good in comparison to being, let's say, at a track day or even on a test day or something. You go out.
Even on a track day, there's too many distractions. Like, there's the yellow flags, the red flags, the overtaking rules and all of that. And there'll be like 40 cars on track. Whereas at Bruntingthorpe, it's like hired semi-exclusive. And there'll be no more than 7 cars there. And we're all doing our own thing at our own pace. And all the cars are roughly the same speed.
Yeah.
And so that's what makes it such an ideal place for teaching people.
Yeah, and the time difference between you doing something and being able to get feedback on it. Because even if you're on a normal track day and the person's sitting in the car with you, they can't really have an in-depth conversation and actually stop and break it down. And then the time it takes to do a lap at Bruntingthorpe is pretty quick. So you can basically work on one corner repeatedly over and over and over again. I thought that made a huge difference.
Well, yeah, for ramping up your learning curve. And it's the same with the Nürburgring. I have quite a lot of people come to me and say, right, we want you to coach us at the Nürburgring, the Nordschleife. And I'm like, right, okay. Then it's like, right, how much stuff have you done? And in the end, I turn around and say, look, come over to the UK. Like, at one point, I think I had more German customers from the Nürburgring than I had British and everyone else put together kind of thing. And I said, look, come and do a day with me and we'll go through all the technique and stuff. But they're like, but we want to learn the Nürburgring. It's like, yeah, but we need to work on your technique first. Like, the Nürburgring is very flowing, but of course, you'll never do any more than 14 laps in one day. So you get 14 shots at every corner.
Yeah.
And if your technique's wrong, by the time we get to that corner, I'm pretty certain you'll have forgot if you're fairly new to it. Whereas if we go to Bruntingthorpe, like, it's just under 1.5 miles long. And so you're doing a lap in a minute and a half. So of course, we'll do maybe 100 laps or no, we'll do more than 100 laps. We'll do like 130 laps in a day. And I wouldn't be surprised if 100 of them, you still won't get that corner perfect, and it'll only be the odd few you'll do it. But you need that repetition to understand and get the muscle memory to do it every lap. And of course, once you start going quicker around one corner, then you're going to approach the next one a little bit quicker. So then you've got to adjust your braking for that one to make sure that you don't overcook it into the next corner. And this is where using the small track, and it's just a repetition, which is where you learn it from. My first track that I ended up basically testing a car on was a place called Kirkistown. And basically it's like a triangle with a chicane in it. And it's in Ireland. It's the only place I could test because I didn't have a license at the time because I wasn't old enough. So I ended up testing there. And basically, like I said earlier, I ended up doing 2 days every month there. And basically it was just one track. And Dad was like, until you match the time of the quickest guy around there, there's no point going to any other circuit.
It's valid.
So that's all I did. Like, the thing is, if you lose a second to me in a Renault Clio, you're probably going to lose 4 or 5 seconds to me in anything quicker. So until you conquer that, there's no point in moving into the next category or something faster to learn.
Yeah, that's super valid. Something that I've always wanted to do is do either a VLN race or something at the Nürburgring.
Yep.
The first, obviously, you've done quite a bit of racing at the Nürburgring. You've won the 24 hours?
Yeah, 2016. So, yeah, the highlight of my career that season was. So, of course, it was my first year signing with AMG. So that was obviously huge for me. And then we went and won the biggest race on our calendar. So, of course, yeah, couldn't have asked for a better first season with the manufacturer.
The coolest place in the world. How did you prepare for racing there? Had you raced a bunch there before that?
So I first went there in 2011. Basically, in fact, going back to, I did that day's coaching at Barcelona with a Dutch guy called Klaas Hummel. And during the winter, I like messaged him, said, look, with your budget and my coaching, I think we'd make a great team in the pro-am category. And I heard nothing, and it got to like March, April. And I was like ready to hang up my helmet. This is 2011. Yeah. I'm thinking, right, that's it. I'm finished. And then suddenly I get a phone call off the team manager, and he's like, right. He goes, you're doing the European Le Mans series. He goes, class went through all the inventory and everything. I'm not paying for this. I'm not paying for this, blah, blah, blah. And then right at the end, he said, right, I'm going to pay double because I want Adam to race with me, and literally just threw me a lifeline. And so, of course, I rang him up to say, thank you very much. Right, let's arrange some more testing. And he's like, I'm glad you rang. He goes, I'm going to the Nürburgring tomorrow. He's like, get a flight over to Amsterdam and go by helicopter to the Nordschleife. So I'm like, dad, I need a flight. Like, I was working for my dad at the time, not earning very much money. And so he's like, I'm not paying for you to go there. I was like, no, this is what's happening. He's like, oh, right. Okay, then best do it. So that's what I did. So I went and met him, flew across the Nordschleife. I did two laps. He did two laps. And then he's like, I want a word with you. And at that point, I was like, oh, no. I was like, I've done something wrong. I was like, shit, is that downshift? I was like, oh, no, this is not good. Kind of thing. I was like, I've broken it already. And I was like, flapping. He's like, right, you're doing the races I can't do. I'm thinking, okay, what's the catch? He's like, first race, I'm on family with the holiday. I'm on holiday with the family. I was like, right. So he goes, you're doing that one. I was like, okay. He goes, second race weekend is my wife's birthday. So you're doing that one as well. I was like, right, okay. He goes, third weekend is daughter's graduation. You're doing that one. I'm like, right. He goes, and then there's one more race and then the Nürburgring 24 hours. I'm not going to learn the track in one race. He goes, you're doing that and then you're doing the Nürburgring 24 hours. And I was just like, what the hell? Literally, he just threw me a lifeline kind
of
thing.
That's amazing.
And as I got to know Klaas more and more, I realized that he got a lot more pleasure and satisfaction out of seeing other people enjoying themselves. Like, he's extremely successful at what he does. He's made his fortune, and we went racing together, and then basically he sponsored me to do some of this. That's racing awesome. at the Nürburgring. So that was 2011. We had a few wins in the VLN in our category. Like the first few laps that I did, I remember I came in the pits and I was like, how was that? And the guy was like, yeah, it was okay. And I was like, what lap time did I do? And they're like, don't worry about it. I was like, no, tell me the lap time. They're like, 12 minutes. And I was like, right, okay. It's a 25 kilometer lap. And I'm like, right, okay. So I was like, so what's a good lap time? They're like, 9 minutes. And I was like, what? I was like, 3 minutes off the pace. I was like, is that even possible? So anyway, so of course, next lap, suddenly I'm pushing a bit harder. I'm like, obviously hanging on to this thing, thinking, oh my God, like, as a kid, I used to play on Gran Turismo. And I swear I picked it up a bit quicker than some of my teammates at the time. Even though I only found out it was going the day before, I remembered certain parts from Gran Turismo. And there's two sections of the track, which I can't tell you which two parts now. At the time, I thought looked very similar, except one went into like a fast left and one went into a slow left. And I couldn't remember, I still can't think in my head which two parts of the track. I was getting confused when I first went there anyway. By the end of the day, I'd got down to like the next lap I'd taken a whole minute off my time. Then I took like 40 seconds, then 25 seconds, and just chipped away the whole day. I did all of 9 laps. And I got down to a 9:14. So at the end of the day, I was like, so go on then, what is the fastest time? They were like, well, actually, it's a 9:10 in this category. Oh, I'm going to smash that tomorrow. Anyway, the next day we get there, and there's like three times the amount of cars. Right, the first day there was only 50 cars. Yeah. The second day there was 150 cars. I'm like, there's traffic. Okay, Adam. There's traffic. Okay, Adam. There's traffic. Adam, there's always traffic. You don't need to tell us. I'm like, oh. Okay, then like with the German accents, I was like, okay, sorry. So and I couldn't get within 10 seconds of the previous day.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh man, anyway, it took me until like my third race and I eventually smashed it and I managed to get down to an 8:55 and that lap record held for quite a few years. Nice. And so that was brilliant. So we ended up doing that and then I got given the opportunity to do this, the Nürburgring 24 hours the year after with Pro Sport. And then I went back with the original team the year after. And I just managed to keep the ball rolling. And then I eventually put a deal together with Black Falcon. Again, thanks to the helper class that the second year there, someone kept on asking him, come and do the race, come and do the race. He's like, I won't do it. But he goes, I know a driver that will. And so he goes to me, he's like, right, Adam. He goes, do you want to do this race? I was like, yeah, I'd love to. And he turns around, he goes, right, the team wants X amount. I was like, ooh. I was like, I haven't got that money, don't worry. He's like, no, he goes, look, He goes, I'll give you some money towards it. I'm like, right. I was like, well, you don't have to. He's like, no. He goes, this is what we'll do. So he goes, but you have to see how you can generate the rest or whatever. So I spoke to the team anyway. I eventually went back to him. And I was like, Glass, look. I was like, I've managed to save you some money. I was like, what do you mean? I was like, and he goes, well, look, I've managed to negotiate it down to this price. He's like, all right, wow. And so, but they want half of it in cash. And he was like, okay, no problem. So I was like, in my head, I was expecting to receive like a briefcase full of cash.
Full of cash to pay.
Yeah, to pay for this thing. And of course, like in Europe, you get 500 euro notes.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, so next thing I know, like that evening, he's like, here you go, here's your money. And he gives it me in this envelope. So like, put it in my pocket as if like it's normal. I'm like, right, okay, then. Like, just got a few grand in my pocket kind of thing. And I remember going back to the bedroom, like, spreading it all over the bed. I was like, oh, my God, look at all this money kind of thing. Like, took a photo or two, sent it to my cousin. I was like, look at all this cash.
And couple
like,
for the gram.
Yeah, right. So, like, I was like, right. They're like, what the hell, where's this from? So anyway, I went there, did the race, and we knew we had a quick car. This is 2012. We knew we had a quick car. And it was the Porsche GT4, but this was the old... This is one of the, it was like a cup car. So it got the sequential, but it got a small wing on it, extra weight and a small restrictor on it. And so we knew it was in a strong position. So we're like, well, let's not go too quick. And so we decided, because of course, going back to the BOP thing, we're like, well, if we get to this bridge before this time, we'll slow down for the last sector. So we don't set off too many alarm bells kind of thing. Anyway, three of us all do our lap. And then the one driver goes out and he goes and smashes us all the way by like 15 seconds. We're like, what'd you do that for? And he's like, you set the bridge. We're like, yeah, the bridge. And he was like, this bridge. And we were like, no, the one before. And so, like, so anyway, so we were panicking. We were like far too quick at this point. Thankfully, one of the Ginettas eventually got close enough and ended up just pipping us and we ended up second. So we're like, okay, that's fine. At least we're like under the radar kind of thing. So anyway, so in the race, I'm in the car and it's looking good. We're in the lead and we're probably like 4 hours into the race. And I feel this little vibration. Don't think anything of it. Just, oh, it's a bit of pickup or something. Next thing I know, the front left tyre just goes, right, massive blowout kind of thing. And the driver's door right next to me just goes, gone. I'm like, literally, I'm hanging on to this thing. Like, oh, my God. And I'm like looking at the barriers. I'm veering towards it. This is on the Dottinger Hoes. So I'm like doing, I don't know, 250 kilometres an hour at this point. I'm like, oh, my God. Anyway, I got on the power and it like picked the front up and it went back in a straight line. So eventually slowed down, came straight in the pits. So it came in the pits and they're like, oh, no. So they took the wheel off, realised that the part of the tyre had gone through the radiator, so they had to replace the radiator. We lost like five laps. It cost us 55 minutes in the pits. Chris Esser from Pro Sport comes up to me and goes, the other drivers don't want to do it, but do you want to go and do a lap? We don't have a spare door. I was like, what? I was like, well, we've got a window net. And they're like, yeah. So they put the window net in. So anyway, so I did like my first lap on the Grand Prix circuit, came back in, they topped up the water. And they're like, how was it? I was like, we need some holes in the rear window. So like straight with the big circlers. Like saw drill, like straight through the rear window, like the plexiglassing, because like the window was like, like buffering really bad. So anyway, so we ended up doing that. I did one lap on the Grand Prix and like, of course, I'm like going out and like, I just had the urge that everyone that I went past, because it's on the driver's side, I just wanted to go, hello, like, stick my hand out, like just like wave at people. I was like, no, just
don't
like,
do that.
Yeah, don't do that. Just like, stay undercover, like don't draw attention to yourself. What I didn't realise is like the helicopter was following us for like three laps. Look at this guy. Like you can see my elbow like out the side of the door kind of thing. He's got no door. Like you wouldn't be allowed to do it now.
Yeah.
But back then things were a little more relaxed. So I did the first lap and Chris was like, how was it? I was like, yeah, it's okay. Except going over the jumps, the car would always twist. Because obviously there was like a load of drag or something on the one side. So I just had to be a bit careful. It's like a rally car kind of thing. Anyway, so I do the first lap and he's like, how is it? I was like, yeah, it seems okay. And they're like, good. We'll see you in eight laps then. So I ended up doing a whole stint without a door kind of thing. Anyway, we eventually came in the pits. They had a spare door off another car. So they put that on. So like, obviously they just stuck the number on the door and off we went kind of thing. Anyway, we ended up from like, I think five laps down or six laps down. We ended up finishing like a lap and a half down or something.
Nice.
And we finished third in class and we only beat fourth place by like 2 minutes. And so, like, okay, sounds like a long time, but 2 minutes around the Nordschleife is, like, not even not a fifth of the lap kind of thing. So, of course, we finished third and, like, celebrating. Everything's going great kind of thing. Next thing we know, the team owner gets a phone call. You, like, you've been using my car for the 24 hours. How can you? I'm going to sue you. And the guy's, like, losing his mind down the phone. Chris is like, what do you want about it? This is my car. And he's like, no. He goes, look, there's my stickers on the car. And he's like, oh no, he goes, that's just your door. He goes, we had to go back to the workshop and take a door off one of the other cars, basically. Like, Yeah, we ended up borrowing his door off his race his car and just putting it onto ours, just so we had a door for the remainder of the race. and then Chris got another phone call, like, "Oh, we have something of yours," and like, "It's like, what do you mean?" He goes, "We've got your door." He's like, "What do you?" He's like, "Have you got my number?" And basically, because it was a brand new team to me, I didn't know any of the team. One thing I've always been taught for the Nürburgring was to take your phone with you. So I took my phone and I sellotaped his telephone number onto the door and literally just stuck it onto the door. So at the end of the race, after the race had finished, one of the marshals rang up, "Hey, we've got your door." So like, literally we sent one of the mechanics and he got to the door and like, it's like, how do I carry a door and a, like, on a moped? So basically they got a roll of tank tape, like wrapped it around him and the door. So he was like a Ninja Turtle coming back with this like door strapped to his back. So this is 2012, and in the end, I ended up racing with the Pro Sport boys in their Porsche for quite a few years. We ended up doing the European Championship, which we won as a team, and in 2013, that was. And then it got to 2014, so I did 3 years in GT4 there, because that was the only opportunity I'd been given at the time. But I knew the track inside out, and we missed one race at the end of the previous season, and Klaas, the guy that I was racing with, the Dutch guy, he was like, "Look," he's like, "the team got some money." He goes, "You can do," he goes, "that's the money for you to use towards whatever you want." Basically, again, just threw me another lifeline. He's like, "You can either leave it with the team, or you can take it out, give it to another team, or you can take it out and invest it into something." And I was like, "Right, wow, okay then." So I did, like, negotiated with the team. I had one VLN test day, one VLN race, and the Nürburgring 24 hours back in 2014. So we did the test day and I was like 6 seconds off the pace and I couldn't compute that someone was quicker than me. I'd got the lap record in like 3 or 4 different categories at this time, but they're all the smaller categories. Suddenly, of course, I was in the top category at the Nürburgring and I just wasn't used to the extra downforce. Again, going back to, even though I'd raced GT3s for some time, I'd just never raced a GT3 around the green hell, the Nordschleife kind of thing. And of course, some of the high speed corners, you're cornering at like 230, 240 kilometers an hour. And like, you're having a little breather kind of thing and you're hanging on kind of thing. So that was the first test day. And then we got to the first race weekend and me and Andreas exited the pits at the same time. I was like, right, if I can just hang on to him. So anyway, so by the end of the first lap, because it was like a one lap, like qualifying, the first lap was always the clearest. So did the first lap and then I ended up 3 seconds off him. I was like, okay, well, that's better than obviously last time where it was 6 seconds. I was like, great. So I started the race. Someone else started in that car. And during the race, I got straight into second off the start. And I found myself like fighting for the lead. And I remember coming in the pits like shaking because I was like, oh my God, what just happened? So like, I ended up coming in like buzzing. This was the race before the 24 hours. Everything's going great. The race ended up being red flagged just as we'd pitted, unfortunately. So we ended up finishing fifth in that race. But our sister car that we were fighting with ended up winning. And then it was the 24 hours, like a few weeks after. So we got there and, of course, I'm still an unknown to a lot of people. I've only done one GT3 race. So we get there and it comes to the Super Pole and there's 30 cars and I go out and end up qualifying fourth. And everyone's like, who the hell is this Chris Dedulu? And I, of course, I'm absolutely loving it and buzzing because I qualified fourth, top Mercedes, top Brit, just buzzing. So that's all good. And everyone's like, who the hell is this Chris Dedulu? If he can do that time, what time would Bernd Schneider have done? And they're like, well, and like, fair enough to Bernie. He turned around and he goes, well, he did the qualifying because he was quicker than me. And so I was like, wow, like to hear that from someone of Bernd's status is incredible. So that was brilliant. And then during the race, we were running fourth and unfortunately, that was the year after. So that race we didn't finish. The year after, I remember Sean Paul, or during that race, after our car was out of the race, he's like, he goes, you should have been in the number one car. And so the year after, I ended with the contract for the number one car. And so that was like my official, like first professional, like drive where I didn't have to bring any sponsorship or anything. And I actually made a small salary from it. So of course I was buzzing kind of thing. So I ended up doing that race. And unfortunately the wheel fell off and I ran around like a maniac trying to like fit this wheel back on the car. And it took me 2 hours to get back after eventually managed to get some tools and stuff. And then the year after it was 2016 and I signed with AMG and we won. And so like, it's just one of these, it just snowballed in the right direction, thankfully. And I believe I've been in the right place at the right time for many things and surrounded myself with the correct people and they've helped support me along the way. And it's been pretty awesome. And now I'm just getting busier and busier. And like, if I could, I'd race almost every weekend kind of thing. So at the end of the day, that's as a driver, that's all we want to do. And so to earn a living from it's just like a bonus.
That's pretty awesome. How often are you racing at the moment? Like, what sort of intervals?
So this season, I think I've raced myself 21 weekends this season.
Okay, that's quite a lot.
And so it's been super busy because, of course, generally around January, February, not much happens. And it's the same for like November and December. Yeah. But the season seems to be getting longer and longer, which is great. Like, I'm happy for it to be. Like, Dubai is always a great season opener at the start of the season. That's like the second or third weekend of January. Then there's Bathurst. I've been lucky to have gone there the last few years. I haven't raced every year, but I've been there as driver coach and doing strategy for one of the teams. I raced there a few years ago. So that was awesome as well. And then the European season starts testing around like February, March kind of thing, some of the warmer places within Europe. But also at the same time, like last winter, I did a lot of coaching out in Dubai and Abu Dhabi. And so that kept me busy through that part of the season as well. And of course, I must have spent like 7 or 8 weeks over there over 4 months. And so, in fact, I just came back from Dubai last week on the way back from China. I thought, well, not much is happening in the UK this week. So yeah. I spent it in the warmer conditions with Lydia and a few friends. It was her birthday, so we went over there, and I've left her over there because now on Thursday I go back to the Nürburgring, and then after that I go to China. So she's enjoying the decent weather, and whilst I'm still gallivanting.
Pretty hectic timing schedule. Do you find it difficult to sort of, I don't know, like stay fit and just generally deal with all the travel?
Sometimes. So actually, I think I'm fitter this year than I have been the last 2 or 3 years. And so during the winter, I don't know why, but I decided I wanted to start working on my my legs. Yeah. I was fed up of them looking like chicken legs. And so I've been like ramping up all my weights and all of that. And I suppose, like, I've always been intrigued with data, whether it's for racing or whatever. Yeah. So like I jot absolutely everything down with all my training and stuff now. And like I've increased all my weights that I'm doing by like 50% compared to what I started at like half a year ago kind of thing. And so this is just for my legs kind of thing. They don't seem to be looking any bigger, but they're definitely stronger than what they used to be. And then I just try and train when I can. So thankfully, like I'm a pretty good sleeper. So when I get on the flights, I can generally just switch off and fall asleep straight away. And then when I'm back, like I landed in China, I think it was 9 o'clock the other week. And of course there's a 7 hour difference to the UK. So I landed and got to the hotel at like 11:30 and I just wasn't ready for bed. So that's that stuff. So I went and spent an hour in the gym there. Just I thought, well, I might as well. We didn't have to get up early the next morning for testing. So I just went and did a quick training session. And one thing I do enjoy actually is we seem to do it a lot in China where after the day's testing, there'll be a handful of us that will go and run around the track.
Okay.
Generally, the weather is 20 degrees plus. Yeah. So it's very pleasant. It's quite humid, but it's just nice to, like, I suppose we all sort of egg each other on to at least run around the track and at least do some fitness because otherwise it's easy to sit down and it's like, oh, we'll go for dinner. And then before you know it, like, I am pretty conscious of the condition that I want to be in. And I realized that a few years ago, suddenly I was like looking down thinking, oh man, I'm 30 now. Where's that tummy come from? Like, that's not right. It like just suddenly appeared overnight. So I've started doing quite a bit more running and cycling recently, but it's just sunny. The conditions have got a lot colder in the UK, so I think we're going to be in the gym quite a bit more.
Do you need to be quite fit to drive a GT3 car, or is it more beneficial?
It's definitely more beneficial if you're fitter. So, like as I said earlier, like we can be in the cars for up to 3 hours, and so because of that, you've just got to be mentally prepared, but also physically, you need to be prepared for that. Like during a 24 hours we can be in the car for, I think the maximum you can do is like 11 or 12 hours, and if one of your teammates isn't feeling well or something happens, you've got to be ready to be able to
get in the car
kind of thing. And so it definitely helps. So like during a race weekend, or especially during a 24 hours, like you'll know that you'll have at least 2 hours off, so I generally get out like quick wash kind of thing, and then I just go and eat. And during a 24 hours I reckon I must have 6 or 7 meals during the race. Like every time I come in after a stint, I just eat, and then you try and rehydrate. Like you can drink like two liters and you still won't need the toilet for the next 2 hours, because the amount that you sweat, it's incredible. Like you can lose like 3-4 kilos in a 2 hour stint, depending on how warm it is. We have some of the teams supply the physios and that, and they'll weigh you before you get in the car, just like in your underwear, and then they'll weigh you after you get out of the car. And like they'll weigh the difference of your suit, and your suit's suddenly like 3 kilos heavier. Oh, wow. You've just like sweated into the thing. So it is important to make sure you're on top form. But at the same time, like obviously some of these gentlemen drivers and businessmen aren't able to do that. But I suppose that's why we have to be on the top of our game to make sure that we're doing our part to help them guys as much as possible.
When you're racing with an AM driver or with a gentleman driver, I guess getting them fast is way more important than most of the pro drivers that probably sit very similar lap times.
Yes, yeah. So like all pro drivers are going to be within 3-4 tenths.
Yeah.
And then obviously there'll be little differences between the cars. Whereas like what I've started doing, especially like when I'm in China and that, like we'll get like 5 sets of tyres for the weekend. So before qualifying, I'll try and give my teammate maybe 2 of them.
Hmm.
And then he'll do like he'll simulate a qualifying session, and then we'll maybe pit him like a lap early. So we'll give him like 3-4 laps, then we'll come in. And then I'll go out and I'll get to try and push as well. And I'll get a tyre that's, okay, it's not brand new, but I get a good idea of roughly where it's going to be, because a tyre is always its quickest when it's brand spanking new kind of thing. That's when it's got the fresh rubber. You get that little bit of extra twist out of the tyre so you can get it rotated. You can be harder on the power. And so, of course, you don't want to go into qualifying with a complete surprise. So I try and give Eric all the tyres, because the thing is I might find like 2-3 tenths, but if I give him 2 sets of tyres and then he goes into qualifying and then he just goes bang a second quicker, that's a lot more of a bigger advantage for us as a pairing than me finding that extra 2 tenths.
How does the grid work for the races and stuff like that in terms of qualifying?
Depending on what championship. So like in Blancpain, it's a combination of all 3 drivers.
Yeah.
So again, like if I was doing that in a pro-am category, I'd give the AM driver as many new sets of tyres as possible, or like within our budget, so that, because I'll find X amount on the tyre, but if I can get them to find more,
it's worth more.
It's worth more over the average of the 3 drivers.
So they do an average. So you're qualifying for Blancpain.
For Blancpain endurance, it is. Except the Spa 24 hours, where everyone goes out and qualifying, and then it's the top 20 they designate one driver to go and do a super pole lap. So that's just an extra shootout. In British, normally if it's a 2 race weekend, the AM driver goes out first, sets his qualifying time. So that's for race 1. And then the pro goes out in the second qualifying and sets his lap time for race 2. So that's the 2 races. If it's a 2 or 3 hour race where that's all there is in the weekend, then it's combined qualifying for British. In China, qualifying 1 is the pro drivers, and that's for race 1. But the pro doesn't have to start race 1. This is where it starts to get confusing. Like each championship's got its own rules, and there's no right or wrong way about doing it. It's just different rules, and everyone has to manage the best situation from those rules, the rules that they've been given, to try and beat everyone else. GT Open, I think qualifying 1 driver does race 1 start, qualifying 2 driver does race 2 start. So it just depends. But at the end of the day, you want to be in the best position. Like if you're going for a championship, you want the best average, obviously, out of everyone. So you've got to do with whatever you believe is going to give you the biggest advantage. Generally, when you start the race, your tyres are going to be fresh. So you never want to burn the tyres all the way to the very end of their life, because it's unrealistic that in a lot of championships, you're only doing a 30-minute stint and you're not going to need the tyres at the end of their life. You're only going to need it for half an hour stint. So that's where like it could be a different qualifying setup to a race setup. Qualifying, you might want it a bit more racy, but it'll burn the tyres off faster. So then for the race, you might like have it a little bit more conservative. But in the end, over the average, it's going to be better towards the end of the stint. So there's 1,001 things you can change. And at the end, you're trying to get your best qualifying position and then obviously figure out the best way to get to the checkered flag first out of everyone else.
Are you racing flat out the entire time?
It depends on what kind of race. So like the Nürburgring, yes, you've got to, because there's no safety cars. There's only slow zones.
Right.
So you've got to go flat out on every corner, every straight, and get whatever advantage you can, whether it's through the traffic or whatever, because there's no safety car. So you don't have to worry about it bunching everyone back up.
Right.
And of course, with it being 25 kilometers, let's say you get an advantage and you get onto the Nordschleife, and then suddenly the heavens open and the other guys are able to pit, like your next lap, if it's wet and you're on slicks, you could lose 4 or 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And if they're only 2 minutes behind, which sounds like a massive advantage, that's like a lap advantage around every other normal track, you can lose that within a lap kind of thing if you're unfortunate with how that falls. So you've got to race flat out all the time. And you've got to try and take advantage if there's some huge slow zones and you know they're getting towards the end of being cleared. If you can pit during that slow zone, whilst the slow zone's on the track, and then get out, and thankfully if it's gone, then that's a massive advantage for you. So you've got to go flat out there. Spa is pretty flat out as well, but of course the safety cars, the thing with Spa is there's two safety cars.
Yeah.
So you've got to make sure that you're in the correct chain, like train with the leader if you're fighting, or well, whether you're in that your category or going for the outright to win. At Daytona, for like the Daytona 24 hours, if it used to be whoever was on the lead lap for like the last hour had a chance of winning, because every time there's a safety car at Daytona, it's a minimum of four laps. So you can unlap yourself on the first lap. Like, they get everyone to queue up, and then like lap two is prototypes all come in. Lap three are GTs come in. So when the prototypes come in, if you're at the front of the GTs and all the GTs come in and you're a lap down, you're allowed to unlap yourself and catch them
up. Oh, nice.
And then lap four of the safety car is something along those lines. Lap four is anyone that's a lap down is allowed. So you can actually unlap yourself twice during a safety car in America, just with how Daytona falls. But unfortunately, that caught us out a little bit, maybe 2 years ago, because normally, like Daytona, there's always a safety car in the last hour. And of course, that bunches everyone up.
Yeah.
You get back on the lead lap and then you fight to the death kind of thing. Whereas the other year, we decided to go for the 18-hour mark. Like, if you're leading during the 18 hours, you get full points at 18 hours. So that goes towards your championship. Okay. So we went for that. Everyone pitted at the safety car, like, 20 minutes before, and we were like, stuff it, we'll go for the points. There's 6 hours to go. There's going to be another safety car. And unfortunately, there wasn't.
Oh, no.
And so in the end, we ended up finishing fourth. And so, of course, the thing is, we'd have just never predicted that, because in previous years, there's always like 20 safety cars, and that year, there's only four.
Yeah.
And so that caught us out, unfortunately. So I suppose that's becoming more of a race where you've just got to go flat out and you've got to go with the strategy rather than getting the points for the championship. In the end, the team won the endurance championship, the IMSA endurance championship, the last 2 years in a row. So those points are extremely valuable to them. But unfortunately, it sort of hindered us winning that race, which I was only doing that race. So, of course, for me, I'd prefer to have won the race.
Win.
Yeah. But anyway, so it depends on the 24 hours now. But the cars are built strong enough that you can go flat out. You just got to be a little careful with curves. And obviously, you never want contact, because the thing is, like, you spend hours and hours, or the team spends hours and hours, like, perfecting the setup of these cars, making sure the thing's perfectly balanced. And if you go and launch over a massive curb, or you have contact with someone and you knock the front toe out, or get a puncture or something, then suddenly your chances of succeeding or being successful in that race are very slim.
Yeah.
So, and it happens in a lot of 24 hours. Like, example, last year and the previous year at the Nürburgring, it's almost anyone that was in the lead. And like, we were leading the Nürburgring 24 hours this year, 2019. I jumped in the car and I was like halfway through my stint, and I didn't have any intention, but I saw the car in front of me heading towards turn one on the Grand Prix circuit. And I was like, right, it's miles ahead. I'll overtake him on the exit of the first two corners. And he just overslowed it a hell of a lot more than I realized. And then he sort of like pulled to the left a little bit. And I was like, oh, he's seen me. He's letting me go. So I went to go down his inside. Next thing I know, he's coming back across. And we had contact, and he cracked the front steering rack, and that put us out of the race. And like, for me, I was like devastated. Like, I was more upset that I felt like I'd let everyone down kind of thing. And we were leading that race. And in the end, I think if we'd continued looking at how the race unfolded, we should have won that thing. But of course, it's one of them things, coulda, woulda, shoulda. Like, we won it in 2016. Last year, we had a chance of winning as well. And it got red flagged. We had like a 2 minute advantage. The Porsche was quicker than us last year. We had a 2 minute advantage. And then it got red flagged and it neutralized the race. The only reason we had the advantage is because the Porsche ended up getting like a 3 or 4 minute penalty for speeding during some of the slow zones, which you're not meant to do. Obviously, you're meant to stick to 60 or 120 kilometers, depending on how severe the slow zone is. And they were taking advantage of that, and they got caught out. So they ended up with a big penalty, which handed us the lead. And then suddenly at the restart, it was a 1 hour sprint, and it was just too strong for us in the super wet conditions, I suppose. Again, like, just having the engine over the back wheels at that time of the race, when it was like everyone was aquaplaning, paid its dividends.
How on earth do you deal with those conditions? Like, I've seen watching it and it's just torrential downpour sometimes.
Yeah, it's tough. So washed, if it's just wet or if it's just dry, it's fine. It's once you get to the aquaplaning stage, which is where I suppose drivers, then it becomes risk versus reward kind of thing. And we had a similar race like that the other week in China where it just started raining heavier and heavier. But at this point, we were in second. We were catching up the leader. Mm. And I was like, come on, keep going. And I was just thinking, I just need this race to last another two laps kind of thing. Because I was thinking in two laps, I reckon I'd be able to get ahead of him. But then you've also got a lead for a whole complete lap as well. Because on the regulations, they go like back a whole lap. So, of course, if you've done a lap and 99%, if they go back a whole lap, the other car could still be ahead of you. So, anyway, literally just as I got within a second of the car after closing the gap down from like 10, 15 seconds, the red flag dropped and that they decided to end the race at that point, which was a bit of a shame. But, of course, it's one of them things. Like, at the time, all I was thinking was, I just need to catch that car up. And even though we were aquaplaning, in fact, I posted that video on YouTube. I'm hanging on in the wet conditions.
Yeah, check out Chris's YouTube channel. Adam.
No, don't worry. So, people call me Chris all the time. I just answer to it now. I'm used to it. Chris, Christo, Adam, I accept them all. So, my YouTube's...
I was having a look on your YouTube channel and you had one of the ones I was checking out. You were talking through a wet lap around Shanghai.
Yeah.
Which... it's really interesting. If you've never watched someone do a wet lap...
Was this where I was talking, during... So I had the mic in my helmet, did I?
I don't know whether...
I doing commentary on top?
It sort of sounded like it was in your helmet.
Yeah, okay, yeah. So I've done two videos. So I've done one where I'm driving whilst I've got a mic in my helmet and that's connected through the radio system. So doing a tour around the track while still hustling it. And then I do one lap, I think, where I'm not talking so I can actually do a correct lap because... even though I thought I was quite good at talking on the radio, I was quite surprised that it slowed me down by about a second. When I was able to just fully focus, I went about a second quicker in those conditions.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And then I also posted one from my last race. This is a longer video. It's about 20 minutes long. And I'm commentating over the video just of some of the thought processes of during whilst it's raining. And you can hear the wheel spinning. You can see me hacking at the wheel as well, just trying to keep it in a straight line at 190 kilometers an hour. And the thing's just trying to turn because it's just aquaplaning at this point. But yeah, YouTube's a little new to me and I'm just trying to...
How are you finding it?
Slow progress. But it's like anything, it doesn't matter what you're doing, the start's always, I suppose, going to be the hardest. Hopefully the more content I can push out there, then the more times or the more chance of it being found and stuff. And I think it's a little unique how I'm doing the commentary whilst I'm driving. I think that's a little different. So I'm explaining, I suppose, the thought process whilst I'm going around, where I'm looking at, where I want to apex, what kind of corner it is. I've been quite lucky that in China, they're quite loose with the regulations, whereas in the UK and Europe, you're not meant to have cameras on your helmet or anything. So I've been doing that and I've got a few my race starts on there. There's a great one from Ningbo where it's a little bit of rubbing and bumping kind of thing, people putting their elbows out and it's a pretty awesome, it's about 2-3 minutes long, just at the first two laps of this awesome little circuit in China where and I've got my onboard helmet on so you can actually see the point of view where I'm looking.
When the first time I saw an onboard that was attached to someone's helmet, it looked so much better than mounted to a car.
Oh yeah, it does. With me, so Ningbo is probably the best example for mine. Where this little track is, you almost feel like it'd be better in a world touring car. It'd be brilliant because you got to munch the curbs, and our GT3 cars aren't built for that. We hit the curbs and you hear it go, and it sounds horrible. Whereas you almost need a rally car or a Dakar car where you can literally just go vroom, vroom, over these curbs and not feel them. It's a proper chassis bender, but it's an awesome little circuit. It reminded me of an oversized go-kart track. But the start, because it is so tight and twisty, in that race I started sixth and by the end of the first lap I was in third and I managed to get into second and then I was chasing down the BMW. But of course, whilst fighting, I try going around the outside of the one corner and I just can't get the thing turned because I've had to brake a little later because I'm going for a further distance around the outside. And I just understood. And then the next side comes back to me. And then thankfully I've got the next corner. And of course you see me looking in the mirror, because as I turn my head, you just pick up the mirror and you can see him like trying to figure out where he's going to try and dive bomb me. And so that's one of my favorite videos. In fact, that was one of my first. And then I was lucky enough that I got to do a video with Shmi as well. That was one of my first. So that was nice to be able to, I felt a bit guided that like, he basically did all the talking. So it made my job easy.
So that was, you did a,
that was in the AMG. Yeah. In the AMG A45 with drift mode on.
Yeah.
I felt under pressure a little bit because AMG are like, right, we want you to drift all the way up Goodwood. And I was like, right, okay. Any of you guys been to Goodwood before? And they're like, and this like talking to the guy that's developed the drift mode. It's like, no. I was like, right, okay. I was like, you seen a lap up there? So I showed them. They're like, oh, it's quite narrow. I was like, yeah, you're telling me. And there's a wall there as well. Yeah. They're like, this might be difficult. So I was in Germany and we set out a cone course. I was like, right, it's going to be roughly second, third gear. So I set out this cone course. I kept wiping the cones out. I was like, oh, man. Like I've spent all my life trying to keep a car as straight as as fast as possible. So drifting to me is a little bit of an unknown kind of thing. So I try it a few times and I keep on wiping these cones out. We're in this car park at Hockenheim, and then I was like, look, I'm doing something wrong. Can you show me how it's done? Because I'd been in the car with him and he was just drifting it beautifully. Legit, literally, we were just like gliding across the tarmac, and I was like, wow, right, okay. So anyway, so he does it and he like wipes it out once for all the cones. I was like, okay. Wipes out the second time. He goes, no, it's impossible. And I was like, oh dear. like how am I going to do this at Goodwood? So anyway, I did my first run at Goodwood. And I got to turn one and I just wasn't going quick enough. And I turned and it just turned. And I was like, oh no, like in my head, I was like, it's going to be turn one, turn two. These are going to be the most.
Those are the money shots.
Yeah, they're the money shots. So anyway, so the first time that happened, I was like, okay, that was a disaster. Right. Second shot, I went and I turned and it just turned far too sharp. And I ended up like going across the grass. I was like, oh no. And then they're like, right, you're taking Shmi up next. I was like, oh, great. So, of course, I got there and I just went in quicker and I just lobbed it in. And I don't know how, but I think a bit of fluke. I just got on the power and had the thing sideways and clipped the grass, like a little puff of smoke, and then sent it into the next one and run the inside grass. And, of course, I came out and I finished. And, like, I was shaking. It was like going back to the Nürburgring. I was shaking and I was like, wow, that was really out of my comfort zone. but thankfully, Tim loved it and so did everyone else.
Yeah,
so,
that's cool.
So that worked out really well. And then I've been lucky enough to meet Aziz and Rockner, and he sort of helped teach me how to edit. And so I've been playing with that the last few weeks.
I saw you had a drive in a Superformance GT40?
Yes.
Around Silverstone.
That was brilliant, like a real childhood dream come true kind of thing. Like on Gran Turismo, that was the car I always wanted to try and afford as soon as I could kind of thing. And so being let loose in one of them was pretty awesome. That was really cool. So that was supplied by Le Mans Classics, and just the experience, like just understanding like the gearbox, obviously, even though it was a right hand drive car, the gearbox was on the right hand side as well. Which is unusual as well. And of course first gear was towards me.
Okay, yeah.
And then it was second, third, fourth. And so, like, even that took a little bit of time to get in my head. The third gear was a little crunchy, which was a bit embarrassing on the video. But I found out later on, Ollie said, he goes, oh, we found a fault with one of the dogs in the gearbox. And so that's why it was crunchy. Well, that's my excuse.
Yeah, yeah.
it wasn't me, obviously. It was the car. So, anyway, like, the noise of that just blew me away. Like, I rang up the week before and I was like, what's the noise limit of Silverstone during the BRDC track day? They're like, it's, I can't remember what they said.
105 or something.
Yeah, like 105. And I rang Ollie. I was like, so what's the noise limit of the car? And he was like, 112. I was like, oh, shoot. I was like, we've got no chance of being able to like drive this. So like basically went out the pits in the first lap. I just took it steady because I thought, if I just get one,
I want to get one in.
I want to get one lap before I get black flagged, kind of thing. So, surprising we didn't get noise tested before. If we were noise tested before, it would have been out. So anyway, so we did that, and then suddenly, like after the start line, I just opened it up, and like he was like, "Yeah, just redline it all the way," like shouting at me, kind of thing. And again, that was just unreal. Like the noise and the grunt that this thing had. And of course, it's on the old school wheels with like the hexagon shaped kind of thing. And the thing just twisted around all the corners, and like it was so much fun. It was so physical as well. Like he was like, "Well, this is how they used to race them. Like no power steering or anything." And it's like, wow, like if you had to race something like that around Spa, your arms would fall off. Mm. Okay, Le Mans, I think, would be a bit easier because at least you get the more sane straight to like take a break kind of thing. But any of the other tracks, I think, like that's when men were men.
I love, I've been to quite a few of the Peter Auto events where people are racing like GT40s and all the stuff. And it's just, you feel, like you said at the beginning, like the noise of all these cars back then and just any car basically before now. Okay, current GT3 cars do sound, they sound badass.
Yeah, but even ours are silenced. Like we run an extra silencer now compared to the SLS just because of racing regulations. And actually when we went back to Daytona the second year, we tried to get the homologation with only the one silencer and it sounded so, so good. But they wouldn't give us the homologation for it, sadly.
It's just unfortunately sign of the times. But
as I said earlier, like we've got used to quiet motorsport, which is a bit of a shame.
Yeah, it is. Most racing drivers I meet aren't necessarily road car guys. Does that sound right? Like, isn't because they're like, okay, I can't take it on track or can't push it on track. Yeah, are you a road car guy as well?
I think I'm more of a classic road car guy. So
right, what's your era?
So a few years ago at Goodwood, my dad was looking at a Mercedes-Benz 190 SL and it's like, he showed me on the auction. It's like, wow, that thing's stunning kind of thing. It looked in mint condition. So we ended up, we signed up onto the website. In fact, we were meant to be going down. It's like, yeah, we'll go on the Saturday. We'll go to the auction and we'll have a look at it and all of that. Anyway, on Friday morning, he gets a phone call. They're like, Mr. Christo, where are you? And he's like, I'm at work. Why? We're waiting for you. He's like, oh, what for? He goes, I'm not there until tomorrow. I'm like, no, it's today, your ticket's today. He's like, no, it's not. He's like, let me just get it. And like, he obviously lost it. Kind of thing. He's like, Adam, how fast can you get down to Goodwood? I was like we were both in Birmingham at the time, and I was just thinking, it's like, it's going to be at least a 4-hour drive to get there with all the traffic and everything. And he's like, oh no, Friday as well. And he's like, God damn it. So anyway, so he's like, right, so we ended up, we registered for the auction online. And he was like, well, maybe we should just check that it works. We had two computers on the go just in case one of them didn't work kind of thing. This is my dad in a nutshell. Like, he obsesses over things.
So. And he's brilliant. Like, he always keeps us entertained. He's always doing something random. And
two lad at the time. So anyway, he's like, right, we need two laptops, two different credit cards on it, just in case. Blah, blah. He's like, maybe we should just check on one of the other lots whether it works.
They can bid or whatever.
Whether we can bid. So anyway, so we left it until the lot before. Like, well, maybe we'll bid on this one. And he was about to. I was like, hold on, we'll just wait for one person to bid. And no one bidded on this thing. And so we almost bought some, like, I don't know, some donkey thing for like 30 grand just testing it. It was like, okay, then, well, it's now or never kind of thing. So anyway, thankfully it worked. And we picked it up at auction. And we got it for a real steal. Like, it's in mint condition and super cool to drive. We've ended up putting a screen just behind the drives just to reduce the buffering. That's the only modern thing we've added to it. It's just cool to drive. Like, old school, super heavy. The guy ended up selling it because basically he restored it and all of that. But he's quite a bit older and he just said he just can't drive it. It's just too hard for him to drive. But he didn't want to add any electric
power steering
or any of the clutch or anything just to make it easier. Because, like, to press the brake, like, you've got to put your leg into it kind of thing. And so, and you got to manhandle it. It's like, if you got a parallel,
it's got a massive steering wheel.
If you got a parallel park it, you're like, like you're having to put your whole body into it kind of thing. And so I really enjoy that. And then we inherited my granddad's old SEL 300, and that thing's really cool. An old 6.3 liter beast. It's the same as like the Red Pig that raced at Spa. Many years ago when it finished second, except obviously they bought that thing out to 6.8 litres. Ours is still the original 6.3 and handles like a bus, but it's brilliant.
Bit of a Mercedes trend then.
Well, yeah, and it's just, I suppose, by fluke luck. Like, that was obviously my granddad's car, this was before, like, signed with Mercedes, with AMG. I suppose just a fortunate fan at the time, and obviously it's turned into something pretty cool.
Do you get a car to drive? Do they give you a car?
Yes, I do. So we get a choice of three. So I've got a C43 coupe at the moment, and it's pretty cool. So I've got that, and then obviously I've got my two Clios, teaching and stuff. So like, if I'm coaching them, I drive them to the circuit or to Bruntingthorpe, wherever I'm using it. But my everyday car is the AMG C43.
Is it good?
Yeah, it's awesome. Four-wheel drive. It's quite fun when the traction control's off in a grass car park at Donington or somewhere. so, no, it's got plenty of go in it. And, okay, not that it ever snows here, but I think it's really popular further east where, obviously, they get the heavy, deep snow and stuff just because the four-wheel drive of it's really good. And so, yeah, it's ideal.
Super practical. Okay, normally towards the end of these podcasts, I have a few questions.
Okay.
So I've got some questions for you. Do you have a most, what's your most memorable driving trip or journey?
Road trip, is it?
Yeah. You could also say race, I guess, because you're a race driver.
Okay, so most memorable one was, I was part of a team, we got a Guinness World Record. And basically we had to drive through as many countries as we could on a single tank of fuel.
Okay.
And so, a bit random, this was 2015, so before I signed with AMG, basically, I got the phone call like the week before. They said, right, this is the plan. They'd been planning it for months, and then they realised that they wanted a driver with a bit more experience. And so, basically, we started off at the very, as far south as we could in Holland, and we ended up doing a Guinness World Record going through as many countries as we could on a single tank of fuel. So we had the Guinness World Record woman with us. We had the RAC also sponsored and supported us for that. And unfortunately, it was in the wrong brand car. But
it was in another car.
but this was really cool. So, like, it was quite strange. So you want to take a random guess how many countries we managed on a tank of fuel?
Something silly. I'm just going to say six, maybe more.
Okay, so it's a few more. So in the end, we managed to go through 14 countries.
14?
Yes.
That's good going.
On tank of fuel. So, in fact, hold on. Let me tell you some of the stats. Hold on. Let me just find. Right. So we did 14 countries and we managed to drive 1,158.9 miles.
What?
On a tank of fuel.
How big was this tank?
So, like, we averaged the speed of, like, I think it was like 51 kilometers an hour during the whole of this journey. So, like, obviously you get into top gear and then you just cruise at minimum revs kind of thing. And we averaged like 76 mpg. So we started in Holland. And we went to Belgium, Luxembourg, France, Switzerland, Liechtenstein, Austria, Germany, Italy, Slovenia, Croatia, Bosnia. That was interesting. Serbia, and then Hungary is where we finished.
Good going.
And so they figured out the most, or the best route to get
the
through
most
all
efficient
the most efficient route to get through all these countries. And they also managed to find like almost the flattest route as well to go through all of this. So we had two cars doing it, and then we had a few support vehicles as well. And so that for me was quite interesting. Like, we did 4 hour stints, half an hour off, 4 hour stints, half an hour off. And each car was almost full of people. And I did the first two stints, and then I was like, right, okay, you can drive now. And I thought, right, I'll have a sleep. And I just couldn't sleep. And I was just bored and uncomfortable. Yeah, so I was like, oh, I'll do the next one. They're like, okay, then. Oh, I'll do the next one. Okay, then. Oh, I'll do the next one. So anyway, so in the end, like, it took like 35 hours or something. But it's like, it sounds like a long time, but actually it went so quick. And I don't know whether it's just because normally when I'm driving somewhere, I'm late and in a rush trying to get there. Whereas for this trip, I think I just had the mentality that I just got to keep on driving as efficiently as possible and get there. And so that was really cool. Just exploring some of these countries as well. And like, we came through, I think it's Slovenia, and like, there was mountains either side, and we're in this valley, and like, literally the sunrise is just like coming over the crest kind of thing. And it's like, I don't know, 5 in the morning, and the sky was just like stunning. And it's just like, wow. And also, like, when we went through Liechtenstein, like, you could see the castle, and like, the sun was setting at that point, and it's just like, it was almost like money can't buy.
Super
like,
cool.
Just an awesome road trip kind of thing.
Sounds like a good one though.
Not a fast one, but
interesting.
But yeah, different.
Okay, next question. 5-car garage, unlimited value. It's got to fit into your lifestyle. That's about it.
So I'd have...
You can have road cars and race
cars. An original Gullwing.
Yeah.
I would have... I drove Mercedes-Benz 722 Stirling Moss years ago. And that was brilliant. Like, we drove that and a Bugatti. And I think just because it was real-wheel drive, like, we got lost and we were going down this country road. And the guy was in, I was like, can I just, like, whip it round? And he's like, yeah, go on then. So, of course, traction control off. Spun it round enough and we went kind of thing, like, in a puff of smoke.
Yeah.
And the Bugatti that was following us had to do like a 17-point turn, like, and then like eventually caught us up. But it was just a cool driver's car. So
you've got an old classic. You've got a nuts.
Oh, is it the CLK Le Mans?
Well, like the DTM.
No, the ones that raced at Le Mans.
Oh, GTR.
Yeah, that would be super, super cool. So obviously a bit of a trend going on here with the Mercs. maybe I'm slightly biased, but so I think that would be cool.
So you've got three, two more. What's your daily in this scenario?
I don't know. God, man, I should have prepped.
You're slightly limited by one brand, to be fair.
Yeah, well, I am at the moment. No, I don't have to be, though. Like, I suppose, like, an old original Ford GT40, that would be pretty cool. But I suppose I still need a modern-day car, don't I?
You need a daily.
Wow.
I mean, you could daily any of those.
If it's like money can't buy, like, then...
Money no object, you can daily anything.
Well, yeah, exactly. That's what I was thinking. I don't know. And then maybe something sensible like an E63S.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Is that sensible?
Yeah, that's reasonably sensible.
You can get more than one passenger in. So,
yeah, you can put some luggage in. All that stuff.
Maybe an estate version.
Don't need
of
to
it.
Start a motor.
Yeah.
Cool. If you could only drive one car for the rest of your life, what would it be? You're allowed a £500 beater.
If I could only drive one car for the rest of my life, it would have to be. Oh man, I was really unprepared for all of these questions. Actually, what did you pick?
For me, it would be some sort of 911, maybe like a Singer or something like that.
Oh yeah, that'd be pretty cool. It'd be some classic, but I just don't know which one.
Don't know. Okay, we'll move on. Is there a car that you think is undervalued at the moment, like market wise? As in, either it's amazing value,
or the AMGs,
all of the
everyone
AMGs.
Buy more, so we can go more, do more racing.
I saw a rumor that with the next 63, you might be a four cylinder. Obviously,
I saw something like that the other day too.
You
can't believe everything you read, can you?
Until it happens.
We're not involved in any of that stuff. So we get involved in the race car stuff, and obviously that's super cool. But that is a completely different.
That would potentially downsize your race car. It might become a four cylinder.
Well. Yeah, I suppose.
Not anytime soon, I think.
No, so the new AMG GT3 has just come out. So we've got the bigger front grille on it. It's got a hell of a lot more cooling for the brakes, for the driver. We've got like all the cooling seats and everything for it now. We've got new ABS traction control system, new rear wing design, like Formula One style. So they can literally just plug a spanner into the end, just spin it around, and that'll increase or decrease the wing angle. And so that's come out. So we're going to be racing that at least for the next 4 years, I believe. So got that to look forward to. So I'll be jumping in that soon to do a little bit of running in that. I was involved a lot with the GT3 development and the GT4 that's out, and so I'll have a little taste of that in a few weeks. So that would be pretty cool. What's the question again?
Undervalued car?
I don't know. I'm not that much of a road car. Like, I like the classic road cars, but I don't pay attention.
You're not that much.
I don't pay attention
up on
to
what's coming out and all exactly. that stuff. Okay, perfectly fair. Right. What's the most... the final one. You should be able to answer this one. What's the most interesting car to you at the moment? Like if you might find yourself like Googling something or you've heard about it, like, oh, that sounds quite cool. Could be a race car, could be a road car.
I've always wanted a project of a classic, like having a classic car and restoring it. And so as a kid, I was, all, and I suppose I still am, a huge Mini fan. Like,
yeah,
I think that's the kind of level that I'd be able to manage right now. So I'd love a classic Mini that we'd be able to restore from like getting all the rust off it and getting it all stripped down, getting it painted how I wanted and put like the Cooper S kit on it. So it's got the flared arches and stuff. I think that would be pretty cool. And I always end up finding myself like every few years, like just pricing one upon
revisiting.
Like pricing it upon Auto Trader, but also like some of the classic Porsches with the wide body kits are pretty sexy looking. So I think maybe I'd start off with the Mini first just to understand how much money
start
I'm going to how much money I'm going to waste on doing a project like this.
Yeah, there's another thing at Ricard. You see all these RSRs and 935s and just generally old cool racing cars driving around and then massive flames, like obscene flames coming
out
of the back.
That's when you had carburetors and like they just dump fuel in for the fun of it and like, of course.
And I think all cars should make, presumably,
all cars should make flames,
like all race cars. If you want your car to get looked at by a lot of eyeballs, it's got a
we
flame
need to
a
involve
bit.
Fire.
And it can't be that much slower just to have a little bit more fuel.
Oh, I don't think it's slower at all. Like when I raced in the Mazda RX-8, like this thing, I screamed. It sounded like it was doing 15,000 RPM. It's doing like 9.5 or something, which is obviously a lot still. But like when you lift it off, like the flames that this thing spat out were like 1.5 meters long kind of thing. And like you didn't want to be in the car next to us because like you'd have no tires or like number stickers or anything left on the side of the car.
It's an extra factor you can work with as a driver. Yeah.
But it was quite warm to race in, that was. But that, I suppose it's more of the old school, like just how they had to cool down the cars and stuff that was, I suppose, quite pleasing to the eye seeing something cool like that happen.
It is very cool. Right, well, that's I think that's about it.
Mega.
Thank you very much. Well, thanks for coming on.
Oh, thank you. Hope I haven't rambled on for too long.
Well, I can tell you. We've been about 2 hours. Solid.
There's going to be some serious amount of editing.
A bit of editing. It's all good.
Lots of cutting out. Any beeping of any bad words.
Nah, all good. Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Cheers.